The Fires of Heaven by Robert Jordan. This book is read by Michael Kramer and Kate Redding. With his coming are the dread fires born again. The hills burn, and the land turns sear. The tides of men run out, and the hours dwindle. The wall is pierced, and the veil of parting raised. Storms rumble beyond the horizon, and the fires of heaven purge the earth. There is no salvation without destruction, no hope this side of death. Fragment from The Prophecies of the Dragon, believe translated by Nadelia Basilane, first made and swordfast to Raiden of Hole Cuchone, circa 400 A.B. Prologue. The First Sparks Fall. Elida do Avrini Aroihan absently fingered the long seven-striped stole about her shoulders, the stole of the Ammerlin seat, as she sat behind her wide writing-table. Many would have accounted her beautiful at first glance, but a second look made it clear that the severity of her ageless, Aes Sedai face was not a momentary matter. Today there was something more, a light of anger in her dark eyes, if anyone had noticed. She barely listened to the women arrayed on stools before her. Their dresses were every color from white to the darkest red, in silk or wool as each woman's taste dictated, yet all but one wore their formal shawls, embroidered white flame of tar valens centered on their backs, colored fringe proclaiming their adjas, as though this were a meeting of the hall of the tower. They discussed reports and rumors of events in the world, trying to sift fact from fancy, trying to decide the tower's course of action, but they seldom even glanced at the woman behind the table, the woman they had sworn to obey. Elida could not keep her full attention on them. They did not know what was really important, or rather they knew, and feared to speak of it. "There is apparently something happening in Shinar." That was Danelle, slight and often seemingly lost in a dream, the only brown sister present. Green and Yellow also had only one sister apiece, and none of the three Ajahs was pleased about that. There were no blues. Now Danelle's big blue eyes looked thoughtfully inward. An unnoticed ink smudge stained her cheek, and her dark gray wool dress was rumpled. "There are rumors of skirmishes, not with Trollocs and not Aiel, though raids through the Niam passes appear to have increased. Between Shinarans, unusual for the borderlands, they seldom fight each other. If they intend to have a civil war, they have chosen the proper time for it," Alviarin said coolly. Tall and slim and all in white silk, she was the one without a shawl. The stole of the keeper around her shoulders was white also, to show she had been raised from the white Aja. Not red, Elida's former Aja, as tradition held. Whites were always cool. "The Trollocs might as well have vanished. The entire blight seems quiet enough for two farmers and a novice to guard." Teslin's bony fingers shuffled papers on her lap, though she did not look at them. One of four red sisters there, more than any other Aja, she ran Elida a close second for severity, though no one had ever thought her beautiful. "Better, perhaps, if it did no be so quiet," Teslin said, her Ilianer accent strong. "I did receive a message this morning that the Marshal General of Saldaya does have an army on the move. No toward the Blight, but in the opposite direction, south and east. He would no ever have done that if the Blight did no seem to be asleep." "Then word of Mazrim Ta'im is seeping out." Alviarin could have been discussing the weather or the price of carpets instead of a potential disaster. Much effort had gone into capturing Ta'im, and as much into hiding his escape. No good to the tower if the world learned they could not hold on to a false dragon once he was taken. "And it seems that Queen Tanobia or Davram Bashir, or both, thinks we cannot be trusted to deal with him again." Dead quiet fell at the mention of Ta'im. The man could channel. He had been on his way to Tar Valon to be gentled, cut off from the one power forever, when he was broken free. Yet that was not what curbed tongues. Once the existence of a man able to channel the one power had been the deepest anathema, Hunting such men down was the main reason of existence for the Red, and every Aja helped as it could. But now most of the women beyond the table shifted on their stools, refusing to meet each other's eyes, because speaking of Taim brought them too close to another subject they did not want to speak aloud. Even Elida felt bile rise in her stomach. Apparently Alviarin experienced no such reluctance. One corner of her mouth quirked momentarily in what might have been smile or grimace. "I will redouble our efforts to retake Taim, and I suggest that a sister be dispatched to counsel Tenobia, someone used to overcoming the sort of stubborn resistance that young woman will put up." Others rushed to help fill the silence. Jolene shifted her green-fringed shawl on slender shoulders and smiled, though it seemed a bit forced. "Yes, she needs an Aes Sedai at her shoulder, someone able to handle Bashir. He has excessive influence with Tenobia. He must move his army back where it can be used if the Blight wakes up." Too much bosom showed in the gap of her shawl, and her pale green silk was too snug, too clinging, and she smiled too much for Elida's liking, especially at men. Greens always did. "The last thing we need now is another army on the march," Shemarin, the Yellow Sister, said quickly. A slightly plump woman, she had somehow never really managed the outward calm of Aes Sedai. There was often a strain of anxiety around her eyes, and more so of late. "And someone to Shinar," added Javindra, another Red. Despite smooth cheeks, her angular face was hard enough to hammer nails. Her voice was harsh. "I don't like trouble of this sort in the borderlands. The last thing we need is Shinar weakening itself to the point where a Trolloc army could break through." "Perhaps," Alviarin nodded, considering. "But there are agents in Shinar, Red, I am sure, and perhaps others?" The four Red sisters nodded tightly, reluctantly. No one else did. "Who can warn us if these small clashes become anything to worry us?" It was an open secret that every Aja, except the White, devoted to logic and philosophy as it was, had watchers and listeners scattered through the nations to varying degrees, though the Yellow Network was believed to be a pitiful thing. There was nothing of sickness or healing they could learn from those who could not channel. Some individual sisters had their own eyes and ears, though perhaps even more closely guarded than agents of the Ajas. The Blues had had the most extensive, both Aja and personal. "As for Tenobia and Davram Bashir," Alviarin went on, "are we agreed that they must be dealt with by sisters?" She hardly waited for heads to nod. "Good. It is done. Memara will do nicely. She will take no nonsense from Tenobia while never letting her see the leash. Now, does anyone have fresh word out of Arad-Doman or Tarabon? If we do not do something there soon, we may find that Padron Nial and the White Cloaks have sway from Bandar Eben to the Shadow Coast. Ivanaline, you have something?" Arad-Doman and Tarabon were racked by civil wars and worse. There was no order anywhere. Elida was surprised they would bring it up. "Only a rumor," the Grey Sister replied. Her silk dress, matching the fringe on her shawl, was finely cut and scooped low at the neck. Often Elida thought the woman should have been green, so concerned was she with her looks and clothes. "Almost everyone in those poor lands is a refugee, including those who might send news. The Panarch Amathera has apparently vanished, and it seems an Aes Sedai may have been involved." Elida's hand tightened on her stole. Nothing touched her face, but her eyes smoldered. The matter of the Saldaean army was done. At least Memara was Red. That was a surprise. But they had not even asked her opinion. It was done. The startling possibility that an Aes Sedai was involved in the disappearance of the Panarch, if this was not another of the thousand improbable tales that drifted from the western coast, could not take Elida's mind from that. There were Aes Sedai scattered from the Arith Ocean to the spine of the world, and the Blues, at least, might do anything. Less than 2 months since they had all knelt to swear fealty to her as the embodiment of the White Tower, and now the decision was made without so much as a glance in her direction. The Ammerlin study sat only a few levels up in the White Tower, yet this room was the heart of the tower, as surely as the tower itself, the color of bleached bone, was the heart of the great island city of Tar Valon, cradled in the river Arinon. And Tar Valon was, or should be, the heart of the world. The room spoke of the power wielded by the long line of women who had occupied it, floor of polished redstone from the mountains of mist, tall fireplace of golden Kandori marble, walls paneled in pale, oddly striped wood marvelously carved with unknown birds and beasts more than 1,000 years ago. Stone like glittering pearls framed the tall arched windows that led onto the balcony overlooking the Ammerlin's private garden, the only stone like it known, salvaged from a nameless city swallowed by the sea of storms during the breaking of the world. A room of power, a reflection of Ammerlin's who had made thrones dance to their calling for nearly 3,000 years, and they did not even ask her opinion. It happened too often, this slighting. Worst, most bitter of all, perhaps, they usurped her authority without even thinking of it. They knew how she had come to the stole, knew their aid had put it on her shoulders. She herself had been too much aware of that, but they presumed too far. It would soon be time to do something about that, but not quite yet. She had put her own stamp on the room, as much as possible, with a writing table ornately carved in triple-linked rings and a heavy chair that raised an inlaid ivory flame of Tar Valon above her dark hair, like a large snowy teardrop. 3 boxes of Altaran lacquer work were arranged on the table, precisely equidistant from each other. One held the finest of her collection of carved miniatures. A white vase on a simple plinth against one wall held red roses that filled the room with sweet fragrance. There had been no rain since she was raised, but fine blossoms were always available with the power. She'd always liked flowers. They could be so easily pruned and trained to produce beauty. 2 paintings hung, where seated she could see them merely by lifting her head. The others avoided looking at them. Among all the Aes Sedai who came to Elida's study, only Alviarin ever so much as glanced at them. "Is there any news of Elaine?" Andaya asked diffidently. A thin, bird-like little woman, outwardly timid despite Aes Sedai features, the second Grey looked an unlikely mediator, but was in fact one of the best. There were still faint traces of Tarabon in her voice. "Or Galad? If Morgaze discovers that we have lost her stepson, she may begin to ask more questions concerning the whereabouts of her daughter, yes? And if she learns we have lost the daughter heir, Andor may become as close to us as Amadisia." A few women shook their heads. There was no news, and Javindra said, "A red sister is in place in the royal palace. Newly raised, so she can easily pass for other than Aes Sedai." She meant that the woman had not yet taken on the agelessness that came with long use of the power. Someone trying to guess the age of any woman in the study would have fumbled over a range of 20 years, and in some cases would be off by twice that. "She is well trained, though, quite strong and a good observer. Morgaze is absorbed in putting forward her claim to the Kyrianan throne." Several women shifted on their stools, and as if realizing she had stepped close to dangerous ground, Javindra hurried on. "And her new lover, Lord Gabriel, seems to be keeping her occupied otherwise." Her thin mouth narrowed even further. "She is completely besotted with the man." "He keeps her concentrated on Kyrian," Alviarin said. "The situation there is nearly as bad as in Tarabon and Arad Doman, with every house contending for the Sun Throne and famine everywhere. Morgaze will re-establish order, but it will take time for her to have the throne secure. Until that is done, she will have little energy left to worry about other matters, even the daughter heir. And I set a clerk the task of sending occasional letters. The woman does a good imitation of Elaine's hand. Morgaze will keep until we can secure proper control of her again."
"At least we still have her son in hand," Jolene smiled.
"Gawain do hardly be in hand," Teslin said sharply.
Those younglings of his do skirmish with the White Cloaks on both sides of the river. He does act on his own as much as at our direction.
He will be brought under control, Alviarin said.
Elida was beginning to find that constant cool composure hateful.
Speaking of the White Cloaks, Donnell put in, it seems that Pedro Niall is conducting secret negotiations, trying to convince Altara and Morandi to cede land to Ilion, and thus keep the Council of Nine from invading one or both.
Safely back from the precipice, the women on the other side of the table nattered on, deciding whether the Lord Captain Commander's negotiations might gain too much influence for the Children of the Light. Perhaps they should be disrupted, so the tower could step in and replace him.
Elida's mouth twisted.
The tower had often in its history been cautious of necessity. Too many feared them, too many distrusted them. But it had never feared anything or anyone. Now it feared.
She raised her eyes to the paintings. One consisted of three wooden panels depicting Bonwyn, the last red to have been raised to the Ammerlin seat 1,000 years before, and the reason no red had worn the stole since. Until Elida. Bonwyn, tall and proud, ordering Aes Sedai in their manipulations of Arthur Hawkwing. Bonwyn, defiant on the white walls of Tar Valon, under siege by Hawkwing's forces. And Bonwyn, kneeling and humbled before the hall of the tower as they stripped her of stole and staff for nearly destroying the tower. Many wondered why Elida had had the triptych retrieved from the storerooms, where it had lain covered in dust. If none spoke openly, she had still heard the whispers. They did not understand that constant reminder of the price of failure was necessary. The second painting was in the new fashion, on stretched canvas, a copy of a street artist's sketch from the distant west. That one caused even more unease among the Aes Sedai who saw it. Two men fought among clouds, seemingly in the sky, wielding lightning for weapons. One had a face of fire. The other was tall and young, with reddish hair. It was the youth who caused the fear, who made even Elida's teeth clench. She was not sure if it was in anger or to keep them from chattering, but fear could and must be controlled. Control was all.
"We are done, then," Alviarin said, rising smoothly from her shawl. The others copied her, adjusting skirts and shawls in preparation for leaving. "In 3 days I will expect—"
"Have I given you leave to go, daughters?"
Those were the first words Elida had spoken since telling them to be seated. They looked at her in surprise. Surprise! Some moved back toward the stools, but not with any haste, and not a word of apology. She had let this go on much too long.
"Since you are standing, you will remain so until I am done."
A moment of confusion caught those half-seated, and she continued as they straightened again uncertainly.
"I have heard no mention of the search for that woman and her companions."
No need to name that woman, Elida's predecessor. They knew who she meant, and Elida found it harder every day even to think the former Ammerlin's name. All of her current problems, all, could be laid at that woman's feet.
"It is difficult," Alviarin said evenly, "since we have bolstered the rumors that she was executed."
The woman had ice for blood. Elida met her eyes firmly until she added a belated, "Mother." But it was too placid, even casual. Elida swung her gaze to the others, made her voice steel.
"Jolene, you have charge of that search and of the investigation of her escape. In both cases I hear of nothing but difficulties. Perhaps a daily penance will help you increase your diligence, daughter. Write out what you think suitable and submit it to me. Should I find it less than suitable, I will triple it."
Jolene's ever-present smile faded in satisfactory fashion. She opened her mouth, then closed it again under Elida's steady stare. Finally, she curtsied deeply.
"As you command, mother."
The words were tight, the meekness forced, but it would do, for now. And what of trying to bring back those who fled? If anything, Elida's tone was even harder. The return of the Aes Sedai who had run away when that woman was deposed meant the return of Blues to the tower. She was not sure she could ever trust any Blue, but then she was not sure she could ever bring herself to trust any who had fled instead of hailing her ascension. Yet the tower must be whole again. Javindra was overseeing that task. Again, there are difficulties. Her features remained as severe as ever, but she licked her lips quickly at the storm that swept silently across Elida's face. Mother. Elida shook her head. I will not hear of difficulties, daughter. Tomorrow you will place before me a list of everything you have done, including all measures taken to see the world does not learn of any new dissension in the tower. That was deadly important. There was a new Ammerlin, but the world must see the tower as united and strong as ever. If you do not have enough time for the work I give you, perhaps you should give up your place as sitter for the Red in the hall. I must consider it. That will not be necessary, Mother, the hard-faced woman said hurriedly. You will have the report you require tomorrow. I am sure many will start returning soon. Elida was not so certain, however much she wanted it. The tower must be strong. It must. But her point was made. Troubled thoughtfulness marked every eye but Alviarin's. If Elida was ready to come down on one of her own former Aja, and even harder on a Green who had been with her from the first day, perhaps they had made a mistake in treating her as a ceremonial effigy. Perhaps they had put her on the Ammerlin seat, but now she was the Ammerlin. A few more examples in the coming days should drive it home. If necessary, she would have every woman here doing penance till they begged mercy. There are Tyran soldiers in Kyrian as well as Andoran, she went on, ignoring averted eyes. Tyran soldiers sent by the man who took the Stone of Tyr. Shemarin clasped her plump hands tight, and Teslin flinched. Only Alviarin remained unruffled as a frozen pond. Elida flung out her hand and pointed to the painting of two men fighting with lightning. Look at it! Look! Or I will have every last one of you on hands and knees scrubbing floors. If you have not the backbone even to look at a painting, what courage can you have for what is to come? Cowards are no use to the tower! Slowly they raised their eyes, shuffling feet like nervous girls instead of Aes Sedai. Only Alviarin merely looked, and only she appeared untouched. Shemarin wrung her hands, and tears actually welled in her eyes. Something would have to be done about Shemarin. Randall Thor, a man who can channel. The words left Elida's mouth like a whip. They made her own stomach knot up till she feared she might vomit. Somehow she kept her face smooth and pressed on, pushed the words out, stones from a sling. A man fated to go mad and wreak horror with the power before he dies, but more than that. Arad-Doman and Tarabon and everything between is a ruin of rebellion because of him. If the war and famine in Kyrian cannot be tied to him of a certainty, he surely precipitates a greater war there between Tyr and Andor, when the tower needs peace. In Gildan, some mad Shinaran preaches of him to crowds too great for Aleander's army to contain. The greatest danger the tower has ever faced, the greatest threat the world has ever faced, and you cannot make yourselves speak of him? You cannot gaze at his image? Silence answered her. All save Alviarin looked as though their tongues were frozen. Most stared at the young man in the painting, birds hypnotized by a snake. Randall Thor. The name tasted bitter on Elida's lips. Once she had had that young man, so innocent in appearance, within arm's reach, and she had not seen what he was. Her predecessor had known for the light alone knew how long, and had left him to run wild. That woman had told her a great deal before escaping, had said things when put hard to the question that Elida would not let herself believe. If the Forsaken were truly free, all might be lost. But somehow she had managed to refuse some answers, and then escaped before she could be put to the question again. That woman and Moiraine. That woman and the Blue had known all along. Elida intended to have them both back in the tower. They would tell every last scrap of what they knew. They would plead on their knees for death before she was done. She forced herself to go on, though the words curdled in her mouth. Randall Thor is the dragon reborn, daughters. Shemarin's knees gave way and she sat down hard on the floor. Some of the others appeared to have weak knees as well. Elida's eyes flogged them with scorn. There can be no doubt of it. He is the one spoken of in the prophecies. The Dark One is breaking free of his prison. The last battle is coming, and the Dragon Reborn must be there to face him, or the world is doomed to fire and destruction so long as the Wheel of Time turns. And he runs free, daughters. We do not know where he is. We know a dozen places he is not. He is no longer in Tyr. He is not here in the tower, safely shielded as he should be. He brings the whirlwind down on the world, and we must stop it if there is to be any hope of surviving Tarman Gaiden. We must have him in hand to see he fights in the last battle. Or do any of you believe he will go willingly to his prophesied death to save the world? A man who must be going mad already? We must have him in control. Mother, Alviarin began with that irritating lack of emotion, but Elida stopped her with a glare. Putting our hands on Randall Thor is more important by far than skirmishes in Shinar, or whether the Blight is quiet, more important than finding Elaine or Galad, more important even than Mazrim Taim. You will find him. You will! When next I see you, each of you will be ready to tell me in detail what you have done to make it so. Now you may leave me, daughters. A ripple of unsteady curtsies, breathy murmurs of, "As you command, mother," and they came close to running, Jolene helping Shemarin wobbling to her feet. The yellow sister would do nicely for the next example. Some would be necessary to make sure none of them slid back, and she was too weak to be allowed in this council. Of course, this council would not be allowed to continue any longer in any case. The hall would hear her words and leap. All save Alviarin went. For a long moment after the door had closed behind the others, the two women met each other's eyes. Alviarin had been the first, the very first, to hear and agree with the charges against Elida's predecessor, and Alviarin knew full well why she wore the Keeper's stole instead of someone from the Red. The Red Aja had favored Elida unanimously, but the White had not done so, and without wholehearted support from the White, many others might not have come round, in which case Elida would have been in a cell instead of sitting on the Ammerlin seat. That is, if the remains of her head were not decorating a spike for the ravens to play with. Alviarin would not be so easily intimidated as the others, if she could be intimidated at all. There was a disturbing feel of equal to equal in Alviarin's unwavering gaze. A tap at the door sounded loud in the quiet. "Come," Elida snapped. One of the accepted, a pale, slender girl, stepped hesitantly into the room and immediately dropped a curtsy so low her white skirt with its seven bands of color at the hem made a wide pool around her on the floor. From the wideness of her blue eyes and the way she kept them on the floor, she had caught the mood of the women leaving. Where Aes Sedai left shaking, an accepted went at great peril.
"Mother, Master Fane is here. He said you would see him at this hour."
The girl swayed in her crouch, on the point of falling over from stark fear. "Then send him in, girl, instead of keeping him waiting," Elida growled. But she would have had the girls hide if she had not kept the man outside. The anger she held back from Alviarin, she would not let herself think that she did not dare show it. That anger welled up. "And if you cannot learn to speak properly, perhaps the kitchens are a better place for you than the Ammerlin's anteroom. Well, are you going to do as you were told? Move, girl, and tell the mistress of novices you need to be taught to obey with alacrity." The girl squeaked something that might have been a correct response and darted out. With an effort, Elida got hold of herself. It did not concern her whether Sylviana, the new mistress of novices, beat the girl to incoherence or let her off with a lecture. She barely saw novices or accepted unless they intruded on her, and cared less. It was Alviarin she wanted humbled and on her knees. But Fane now. She tapped one finger against her lips. A bony little man with a big nose, who had appeared at the tower only days earlier in dirty, once fine clothes too big for him, arrogant and cringing by turns, seeking audience with the Ammerlin. Except for those who served the tower, men came there only under duress or in great need, and none asked to speak to the Ammerlin. A fool in some ways, or conceivably a half-wit, he claimed to be from Lugard in Mirandi, but spoke in various accents, sometimes slipping from one to another in mid-sentence. Yet it seemed he might be useful. Alviarin was still looking at her, so icily complacent, just a hint in her eyes of the questions she must have about Fane. Elida's face hardened. Almost she reached for Saidar, the female half of the true source, to teach the woman her place with the power. But that was not the way. Alviarin might even resist, and fighting like a farm girl in a stable yard was no method for the Ammerlin to make her authority plain. Yet Alviarin would learn to yield to her as surely as the others would. The first step would be leaving Alviarin in the dark concerning Master Fane, or whatever his real name was.
Padan Fane put the frantic young accepted out of his mind as he stepped into the Ammerlin's study. She was a toothsome bit, and he liked them fluttering like birds in the hand, but there were more important matters to concentrate on now. Dry-washing his hands, he ducked his head suitably low, suitably humbly, but the two awaiting him seemed unaware of his presence at first, locked eye to eye as they were. It was all he could do not to stretch out a hand to caress the tension between them. Tension and division wove everywhere through the White Tower. All to the good. Tension could be tweaked, division exploited, as need be. He had been surprised to find Elida on the Ammerlin seat. Better than what he had expected, though. In many ways she was not so tough, he had heard, as the woman who had worn the stole before her. Harder, yes, and more cruel, but more brittle, too. More difficult to bend, likely, but easier to break. If either became necessary. Still, one Aes Sedai, one Ammerlin even, was much like another to him. Fools. Dangerous fools, true, but useful dupes at times. Finally they realized he was there, the Ammerlin frowning slightly at being taken by surprise, the keeper of the chronicles unchanging. "You may go now, daughter," Elida said firmly, a slight but definite emphasis on now. Oh, yes, the tensions, the cracks in power. Cracks where seeds could be planted. Fane caught himself on the point of giggling. Alviarin hesitated before giving the briefest of curtsies. As she swept out of the room, her eyes brushed across him, expressionless, yet disconcerting. Unconsciously he huddled, hunching his shoulders protectively. His upper lip fluttered in a half-snarl at her slim back. On occasion he had the feeling, just for an instant, that she knew too much about him, but he could not have said why. Her cool face, cool eyes, they never changed. At those times he wanted to make them change. Fear, agony, pleading. He nearly laughed at the thought. No point, of course. She could know nothing. Patience, and he could be done with her, and her never-changing eyes. The tower held things worth a little patience in its strong rooms. The Horn of Alir was there, the fabled horn made to call dead heroes back from the grave for the last battle. Even most of the Aes Sedai were ignorant of that, but he knew how to sniff out things. The dagger was there. He felt its pull where he stood. He could have pointed to it. It was his, a part of him, stolen and mired away here by these Aes Sedai. Having the dagger would make up for so much lost. He was not sure how, but he was sure it would. For Aridhal lost. Too dangerous to return to Aridhal. Perchance to be trapped there again. He shivered. So long trapped. Not again. Of course, no one called it Aridhol any longer, but Shaddar Logoth. Where the Shadow Waits. An apt name. So much had changed. Even himself. Padan Fain. Mordeth. Ordeath. Sometimes he was uncertain which name was really his, who he really was. One thing was sure, he was not what anyone thought. Those who believed they knew him were badly mistaken. He was transfigured now, a force unto himself and beyond any other power. They would all learn, eventually. Suddenly he realized with a start that the Ammerlin had said something. Casting about in his mind, he found it.
"Yes, mother, the coat suits me very well."
He ran a hand down the black velvet to show how fine he found it, as if garments mattered.
"'Tis a very good coat. I am thanking you kindly, mother."
He was prepared to suffer more of her trying to make him feel at ease, ready to kneel and kiss her ring. But this time she went straight to the heart.
"Tell me more of what you know of Randall Thor, Master Fain."
Fane's eyes went to the painting of the two men, and as he gazed at it, his back straightened. Althor's portrait tugged at him almost as much as the man would, sent rage and hate roiling along his veins. Because of that young man, he had suffered pain beyond remembering, pain he did not let himself remember, suffered far worse than pain. He had been broken and remade because of Althor. Of course, that remaking gave him the means of revenge, but that was beside the point. Beside his desire for Althor's destruction, everything else dimmed from sight. When he turned back to the Ammerlin, he did not realize his manner was as commanding as hers, meeting her stare for stare.
"Randall Thor is devious and sly, uncaring of anyone or anything but his own power."
"Fool, woman."
"He's never a one to do what you expect."
But if she could put Althor in his hands...
"He is difficult to lead, very difficult. But I believe it can be done. First you must tie a string to one of the few he trusts."
If she gave him Althor, he might leave her alive when he finally went, even if she was Aes Sedai. Lounging in a gilded chair in his shirt sleeves, one booted leg over the padded arm, Ravine smiled as the woman standing before the fireplace repeated what he had told her. There was a slight glaze in her large brown eyes. A young, pretty woman, even in the plain gray woolens she had adopted for disguise, but that was not what interested him about her. No breath of air stirred through the room's tall windows. Sweat rolled down the woman's face as she spoke, and beaded on the narrow face of the other man present. For all of that man's fine red silk coat with its golden embroidery, he stood as stiffly as a servant, which he was, in a way, if of his own free will, unlike the woman. Of course, he was deaf and blind for the moment. Ravine handled the flows of spirit he had woven around the pair delicately. There was no need to damage valuable servants. He did not sweat, of course. He did not let the summer's lingering heat touch him. He was a tall man, large, dark, and handsome, despite the white streaking his temples. Compulsion had presented no difficulties with this woman. A scowl twisted his face. It did with some. A few, a very few, had a strength of self so firm that their minds searched, even if unaware, for crevices through which to slide away. It was his bad luck that he still had some small need for one such. She could be handled, but she kept trying to find escape without knowing she was trapped. Eventually that one would no longer be needed, of course. He would have to decide whether to send her on her way, or be rid of her more permanently. Dangers lay either way. Nothing that could threaten him, of course, but he was a careful man, meticulous. Small dangers had a way of growing, if ignored, and he always chose his risks with a measure of prudence. To kill her or keep her? The cessation of the woman's speech pulled him from his reverie. "When you leave here," he told her, "you will remember nothing of this visit. You will remember only taking your usual morning walk." She nodded, eager to please him, and he tied off the strands of spirit lightly, so they would evaporate from her mind shortly after she reached the street. Repeated use of compulsion made obedience easier, even when it was not in use, but while it was, there was always a danger it might be detected. That done, he released Eligar's mind as well. Lord Eligar. A minor noble, but faithful to his vows. He licked his thin lips nervously and glanced at the woman, then went immediately to one knee before Ravin. Friends of the Dark, Dark Friends they were called now, had begun learning just how strictly they would be kept to their vows, now that Ravin and the others were freed. "Take her to the street by backways," Ravin said, "and leave her there. She is not to be seen."
"It will be as you say, great master," Eligar said, bowing where he knelt.
Rising, he backed from Ravine's presence, bowing and pulling the woman along by one arm. She went docilely, of course, her eyes still fogged. Eligar would ask her no questions. He knew enough to be well aware that there were things he did not want to know.
"One of your play pretties,"
a woman's voice said behind him as the carved door closed.
"Have you taken them to dressing them like that?"
Snatching at Saidin, he filled himself with the power, the taint of the male half of the true source, rolling off the protection of his bonds and oaths, the ties to what he knew as a greater power than the light or even the creator. In the middle of the chamber, a gateway stood above the red and gold carpet, an opening to somewhere else. He had a brief view of a chamber lined with snowy silken hangings before it vanished, leaving a woman, clad in white and belted in woven silver. The slight tingle in his skin, like a faint chill, was all that told him she had channeled. Tall and slender, she was as beautiful as he was handsome, her dark eyes bottomless pools, her hair decorated with silver stars and crescents falling in perfect black waves to her shoulders. Most men would have felt their mouths go dry with desire.
"What do you mean to come sneaking up on me, Lanfear?" he demanded roughly.
He did not let go of the power, but rather prepared several nasty surprises in case he had need.
"If you want to speak with me, send an emissary, and I will decide when and where. And if."
Lanfear smiled that sweet, treacherous smile.
"You were always a pig, Ravin, but seldom a fool. That woman is Aes Sedai. What if they miss her? Do you also send out heralds to announce where you are?"
"Channel," he sneered. "She is not strong enough to be allowed outdoors without a keeper. They call untutored children Aes Sedai when half what they know is self-taught tricks and the other half barely scratches the surface."
"Would you still be so complacent if those untutored children put a circle of 13 around you?"
The cool mockery in her voice stabbed him, but he did not let it show.
"I take my precautions, Lanfear. Rather than one of my play pretties, as you call them, she is the tower's spy here. Now she reports exactly what I want her to, and she is eager to do so. Those who serve the chosen in the tower told me right where to find her."
The day would come soon when the world gave up the name Forsaken and knelt to the chosen. It had been promised so very long ago.
"Why have you come, Lanfear? Surely not in aid of defenseless women."
She merely shrugged.
"You can play with your toys as much as you wish, so far as I am concerned. You offer little in the way of hospitality, Ravin. So you will forgive me if..."
A silver pitcher rose from a small table by Ravin's bed and tilted to pour dark wine into a gold-chased goblet. As the pitcher settled, the goblet floated to Lanfear's hand. He felt nothing beyond a slight tingle, of course, saw no flows being woven. He had never liked that. That she would be able to see as little of his weaving was only a slight redressing of the balance.
"Why?" he demanded again.
She sipped calmly before speaking.
Since you avoid the rest of us, a few of the Chosen will be coming here. I came first, so you would know it was not an attack.
Others? Some plan of yours? What need have I of someone else's designs?
Suddenly he laughed, a deep, rich sound.
So it is no attack, is it? You were never one for attacking openly, were you? Not as bad as Mogadine, perhaps, but you did always favor the flanks and the rear. I will trust you this time, enough to hear you out, as long as you are under my eye.
Who trusted Lanfear behind him deserved the knife he might well find in his back. Not that she was so very trustworthy even when watched. Her temper was uncertain at best.
Who else is supposed to be part of this?
He had clearer warning this time. It was male work. As another gateway opened, showing marble arches open onto wide stone balconies, and gulls wheeling and crying in a cloudless blue sky. Finally a man appeared and stepped through, the way closing behind him.
Samael was compact, solid, and larger-seeming than he truly was, his stride quick and active, his manner abrupt. Blue-eyed and golden-haired, with a neat, square-trimmed beard, he would perhaps have been above the ordinary in looks, except for a slanting scar, as if a red-hot poker had been dragged across his face from hairline to jaw. He could have had it removed as soon as it was made all those long years ago, but he had elected not to. Linked to Sidene as tightly as Ravin, this close Ravin could feel it dimly, Samael eyed him warily.
I expected serving maids and dancing girls, Ravin. Have you finally wearied of your sport after all these years?
Lanfear laughed softly into her wine.
Did someone mention sport?
Ravin had not even noticed the opening of a third gateway, showing a large room full of pools and fluted columns, nearly nude acrobats and attendants wearing less.
Oddly, a lean old man in a wrinkled coat sat disconsolately among the performers.
Two servants in filmy bits of nothing much, a well-muscled man bearing a wrought gold tray, and a beautiful, voluptuous woman anxiously pouring wine from a cut crystal flagon into a matching goblet on the tray, followed the true arrival before the opening winked out. In any other company but Lanfear's, Grendel would have been accounted a stunningly beautiful woman, lush and ripe. Her gown was green silk cut low. A ruby the size of a hen's egg nestled between her breasts, and a coronet encrusted with more rested on her long, sun-colored hair. Beside Lanfear, she was merely plumply pretty. If the inevitable comparison bothered her, her amused smile gave no sign of it. Golden bracelets clattered as she waved a heavily beringed hand generally behind her. The female servant quickly slipped the goblet into her grasp with a fawning smile, mirrored by the man. Grendel took no notice.
"So," she said gaily, "nearly half the surviving Chosen in one place, and no one trying to kill anyone. Who would have expected it before the great Lord of the Dark returns? Ishamael did manage to keep us from one another's throats for a time, but this..."
"Do you always speak so freely in front of your servants?" Samael said with a grimace.
Grendel blinked, glanced back at the pair as if she had forgotten them.
"They won't speak out of turn. They worship me. Don't you?"
The two fell to their knees, practically babbling their fervent love of her. It was real. They actually did love her. Now. After a moment, she frowned slightly and the servants froze, mouths open in mid-word.
"They do go on. Still, they won't bother you now, will they?"
Ravin shook his head, wondering who they were or had been. Physical beauty was not enough for Grendel's servants. They had to have power or position as well. A former lord for a footman, a lady to draw her bath. That was Grendel's taste. Indulging herself was one thing, but she was wasteful. this pair might have been of use, properly manipulated. But the level of compulsion Grendel employed surely left them good for little more than decoration. The woman had no true finesse.
"Should I expect more, Lanfear?" he growled. "Have you convinced Demundred to stop thinking he is all but the great lord's heir?"
"I doubt he is arrogant enough for that," Lanfear replied smoothly. "He can see where it took Ishamael. And that is the point. A point Grendel raised. Once we were 13, immortal. Now 4 are dead, and 1 has betrayed us. We 4 are all who meet here today, and enough."
"Are you certain Asmodean went over?" Samael demanded. "He never had the courage to take a chance before. Where did he find the heart to join a lost cause?"
Lanfear's brief smile was amused.
"He had the courage for an ambush he thought would set him above the rest of us. And when his choice became death or a doomed cause, it took little courage for him to choose."
"And little time, I'll wager."
The scar made Samael's sneer even more biting.
"If you were close enough to him to know all of this, why did you leave him alive? You could have killed him before he knew you were there."
"I am not as quick as you to kill. It is final with no going back, and there are usually other, more profitable ways. Besides, to put it in terms you would understand, I did not want to launch a frontal assault against superior forces."
"Is he really so strong?" Ravine asked quietly. "This Randall Thor? Could he have overwhelmed you face to face?"
Not that he himself could not, if it came to it, or Samael, though Grendel would likely link with Lanfear if either of the men tried. For that matter, both women were probably filled to bursting with the power right that moment, ready to strike at the slightest suspicion of either man. Or of each other. But this farm boy, an untrained shepherd... Untrained, unless Asmodean was trying.
"He is Luz Theron Telamon reborn," Lanfear said just as softly. "And Luz Theron was as strong as any."
Samael absently rubbed the scar across his face. It had been Luz Theron who gave it to him. 3,000 years ago and more, well before the breaking of the world, before the great lord was imprisoned, before so much... But Samael never forgot.
"Well," Grendel put in, "have we come around at last to what we are here to discuss?"
Ravin gave a displeased start. The two servants were frozen still, or again, rather. Samael muttered in his beard.
"If this Randall Thor really is Luz Theron Telamon reborn..."
Grendel went on, settling herself on the man's back, where he crouched on all fours.
"I am surprised you haven't tried to snuggle him into your bed, Lanfear. Or would it be so easy? I seem to remember Luz Theron led you by the nose, not the other way around. Squelched your little tantrums, sent you running to fetch his wine, in a manner of speaking."
She set her own wine on the tray, held out rigidly by the sightlessly kneeling woman.
"You were so obsessed with him, you'd have stretched out at his feet if he said, rug."
Lanfear's dark eyes glittered for a moment before she regained control of herself.
"He may be Luz Theron reborn, but he is not Luz Theron himself." "How do you know?"
Grendel asked, smiling as if it were all a joke.
"It may well be that, as many believe, all are born and reborn as the wheel turns. But nothing like this has ever happened that I have read. A specific man reborn according to prophecy. Who knows what he is?"
Lanfear gave a disparaging smirk.
"I've observed him closely. He is no more than the shepherd he seems, still more naive than not."
Scorn faded to seriousness.
"But now he has Asmodean, weak ally as he is. And even before Asmodean, 4 of the Chosen have died confronting him.
Let him whittle away the dead wood, Samael said gruffly. He wove flows of air to drag a chair across the carpet, and sprawled with his boots crossed at the ankle and one arm over the low carved back. Anyone who believed he was at ease was a fool. Samael had always liked to dupe his enemies into thinking they could take him by surprise. More for the rest of us on the day of return. Or do you think he might win Tarmangadon, Lanfear? Even if he stiffens Asmodean's backbone, he has no 100 companions this time. With Asmodean or alone, the Great Lord will extinguish him like a broken starlight. The look Lanfear gave him bristled with contempt. How many of us will be alive when the Great Lord is freed at last? Foregone already. Will he come after you next, Samael? You might like that. You could finally get rid of that scar if you defeated him. But I forget. How many times did you face him in the War of Power? Did you ever win? I cannot seem to remember. Without pause, she rounded on Grendel. Or it might be you. He is reluctant to hurt women for some reason, but you won't even be able to make Asmodean's choice. You cannot teach him any more than a stone could. Unless he decides to keep you as a pet. That would be a change for you, would it not? Instead of deciding which of your pretties pleases you best, you could learn to please. Grendel's face contorted, and Ravin prepared to shield himself against whatever the two women might hurl at one another, prepared to travel at even a whiff of balefire. Then he sensed Samael gathering the power, sensed a difference in it. Samael would call it seizing a tactical advantage, and bent to grab the other man's arm. Samael shook him off angrily, but the moment had passed. The two women were looking at them now, not each other. Neither could know what had almost happened, but clearly something had passed between Ravin and Samael, and suspicion lit their eyes. I want to hear what Lanfear has to say. He did not look at Samael, but meant it for him. There must be more to this than a foolish attempt to frighten us. Samael jerked his head in what might have been a nod or merely disgruntlement. It would have to do. Oh, there is, though a little fright could not hurt. Lanfear's dark eyes still held distrust, but her voice was as clear as still water. If Samael tried to control him and failed, tried to kill him in the end and failed, but Ishamael tried bullying and fear, and bullying does not work with Randall Thor.
Ishamael was more than half mad, Samael muttered, and less than half human.
Is that what we are? Grendel arched an eyebrow. Merely human. Surely we are something more. This is human.
She stroked a finger down the cheek of the woman kneeling beside her.
A new word will have to be created to describe us. Whatever we are, Lanfear said, we can succeed where Ishamael failed.
She was leaning slightly forward as if to force the words on them. Lanfear seldom showed tension. Why now?
Why only we four? Ravin asked.
The other why would have to wait.
Why more?
Was Lanfear's reply.
If we can present the dragon reborn kneeling to the Great Lord on the day of return, why share the honor and the rewards further than need be? And perhaps he can even be used to, how did you put it, Samael, whittle away the dead wood?
It was the sort of answer Ravin could understand. Not that he trusted her, of course, or any of the others, but he understood ambition. The Chosen had plotted among themselves for position up to the day Luz Theron had imprisoned them in sealing up the Great Lord's prison, and they had begun again the day they were freed. He just had to be sure Lanfear's plot did not disrupt his own plans.
Speak on, he told her.
First, someone else is trying to control him, perhaps to kill. I suspect Mogadin, or Dimondred. Mogadin has always tried to work from the shadows, and Dimondred always did hate Luz Theron.
Samael smiled, or perhaps grimaced, but his hatred was a pale thing beside Demondred's, though for better cause.
"How do you know it is not one of us here?"
Grendel asked glibly. Lanfear's smile showed as many teeth as the other woman's, and as little warmth.
"Because you three choose to carve out niches for yourselves and secure your power, while the rest slash at each other. And other reasons. I told you I keep a close watch on Randall Thor."
It was true what she said of them. Ravin himself preferred diplomacy and manipulation to open conflict, though he would not shy from it if needed. Samael's way had always been armies and conquest. He would not go near Luthaeron, even reborn as a shepherd, until he was sure of victory. Grendel, too, followed conquest, though her methods did not involve soldiers. For all her concern with her toys, she took one solid step at a time. Openly, to be sure, as the Chosen reckoned such things, but never stretching too far at any step.
"You know I can keep an eye on him unseen," Lanfear continued, "but the rest of you must stay clear, or run the risk of detection. We must draw him back."
Grendel leaned forward, interested, and Samael began to nod as she went on. Ravin reserved judgment.
"It might well work.
And if not..."
If not, he saw several ways to shape events to his advantage. This might work out very well indeed.
Chapter 1. Fanning the Sparks. The wheel of time turns, and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age by some, an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose in the great forest called Brame Wood. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the Wheel of Time, but it was a beginning. South and west it blew, dry, beneath a sun of molten gold. There had been no rain for long weeks in the land below, and the late summer heat grew day by day. Brown leaves come early, dotted some trees, and naked stones baked where small streams had run. In an open place where grass had vanished and only thin, withered brush held the soil with its roots, the wind began uncovering long-buried stones. They were weathered and worn, and no human eye would have recognized them for the remains of a city remembered in story, yet otherwise forgotten. Scattered villages appeared before the wind crossed the border of Andor, and fields where worried farmers trudged arid furrows. The forest had long since thinned to thickets by the time the wind swept dust down the lone street of a village called Core Springs. The springs were beginning to run low this summer. A few dogs lay panting in the swelter, and two shirtless boys ran, beating a stuffed bladder along the ground with sticks. Nothing else stirred, save the wind and the dust and the creaking sign above the door of the inn, red brick and thatch roofed like every other building along the street. At two stories it was the tallest and largest structure in Core Springs, a neat and orderly little town. The saddled horses hitched in front of the inn barely twitched their tails. The inn's carved sign proclaimed, "The Good Queen's Justice." Blinking against the dust, Min kept an eye pressed to the crack in the shed's rough wall. She could just make out one shoulder of the guard on the shed door, but her attention was all for the inn further on. She wished the name were less ominously apt. Their judge, the local lord, had apparently arrived some time ago, but she had missed seeing him. No doubt he was hearing the farmer's charges. Admiral Nem, along with his brothers and cousins and all their wives, had seemed in favor of an immediate hanging before one of the lord's retainers happened by. She wondered what the penalty was here for burning up a man's barn, and his milk cows with it. By accident, of course, but she did not think that would count for much when it all began with trespass. Loghain had gotten away in the confusion, abandoning them. He would burn him, and she did not know whether to be happy about that or not. It was he who had knocked Nem down when they were discovered just before dawn, sending the man's lantern flying into the straw. The blame was his, if anyone's. Only sometimes he had trouble watching what he said. Perhaps as well he was gone. Twisting to lean back against the wall, she wiped sweat from her brow, though it only sprang out again. The inside of the shed was stifling, but her two companions did not appear to notice. Swan lay stretched out on her back in a dark woolen riding dress, much like Min's, staring at the shed roof, idly tapping her chin with a straw. Coppery-skinned Liana, willowy and as tall as most men, sat cross-legged in her pale shift, working on her dress with needle and thread. They had been allowed to keep their saddlebags after they were searched for swords or axes or anything else that might help them escape. "What's the penalty for burning down a barn in Andor?" Min asked. "If we are lucky," Swan replied without moving. "A strapping in the village square. Not so lucky, and it will be a flogging."
"Light," Min breathed. "How can you call that luck?"
Swan rolled onto her side and propped herself up on an elbow. She was a sturdy woman, short of beautiful, though beyond handsome, and looked no more than a few years older than Min. But those sharp blue eyes had a commanding presence that did not belong on a young woman awaiting trial in a back-country shed. Sometimes Swan was as bad as Loghain about forgetting herself, maybe worse. "When a strapping is done," she said in a brook-no-nonsense, do-not-be-foolish tone, "it is done, and we can be on our way. It wastes less of our time than any other penalty I can think of. Considerably less than hanging, say. Though I don't think it will come to that, from what I remember of Andorran law." Wheezing laughter shook Min for a moment. It was that or cry.
"Time? The way we're going, we've nothing but time. I swear we have been through every village between here and Tar Valon and found nothing. Not a glimmer, not a whisper. I don't think there is any gathering, and we are on foot now. From what I overheard, Loghain took the horses with him. Afoot and locked in a shed, awaiting the light knows what."
"Watch names," Swan whispered sharply, shooting a meaning glance at the rough door with the guard on the other side. "A flapping tongue can put you in the net instead of the fish." Min grimaced, partly because she was growing tired of Swan's tyrant fisherman's sayings, and partly because the other woman was right. So far they had outrun awkward news. Deadly was a better word than awkward. But some news had a way of leaping 100 miles in a day. Swan had been traveling as Mara, Liana as Amena, and Loghain had taken the name Dalin after Swan convinced him Gwere was a fool's choice. Min still did not think anyone would recognize her own name, but Swan insisted on calling her Serenla. Even Loghain did not know their true names. The real trouble was that Swan was not going to give up. Weeks of utter failure and now this, yet any mention of heading for Tyr, which was sensible, set off a tempest that quailed even Loghain. The longer they had searched without finding what Swan sought, the more temper she had developed. Not that she couldn't crack rocks with it before. Min was wise enough to keep that particular thought to herself. Liana finally finished with her dress and tugged it on over her head, doubling her arms behind her to do up the buttons. Min could not see why she had gone to the trouble. She herself hated needlework of any sort. The neckline was a little lower now, showing a bit of Liana's bosom, and it fit in a snugger way there and perhaps around the hips. But what was the point here? No one was going to ask her to dance in this roasting shed. Digging into Min's saddlebags, Liana pulled out the wooden box of paints and powders and whatnots that Laris had forced on Min before they set out. Min had kept meaning to throw it away, but somehow she had never gotten around to it. There was a small mirror inside the hinged lid of the box, and in moments Liana was at work on her face with small rabbit fur brushes. She had never shown any particular interest in the things before. Now she appeared vexed that there was only a blackwood hairbrush and a small ivory comb to use on her hair. She even muttered about the lack of a way to heat the curling iron. Her dark hair had grown since they began Swan's search, but it still came well short of her shoulders. After watching a bit, Min asked, "What are you up to, Amena?" She stopped looking at Swan. She could guard her tongue. It was just being cooped up and baked alive. That on top of the coming trial. A hanging or a public strapping. What a choice. Have you decided to take up flirting? It was meant for a joke. Liana was all business and efficiency, something to enlighten the moment, but the other woman surprised her. Yes, Liana said briskly, peering wide-eyed into the mirror while she carefully did something to her eyelashes. And if I flirt with the right man, perhaps we will not need to worry about strappings or anything else. At the least, I might get us lighter sentences. Hand half raised to wipe her face again, Min gasped. It was like an owl announcing it meant to become a hummingbird. But Swan merely sat up facing Liana with a level, "What brought this on?" Had Swan directed that gaze at her, Min suspected she would have confessed to things she had forgotten. When Swan concentrated on you like that, you found yourself curtsying and leaping to do as you were told before you realized it. Even Loghain did, most of the time, except for the curtsy. Liana calmly stroked a tiny brush along her cheekbones and examined the result in the small mirror. She did glance at Swan, but whatever she saw, she answered in the same crisp tones she always used. My mother was a merchant, you know, in furs and timber mainly. I once saw her fog a Saldaean lord's mind, till he consigned his entire year's timber harvest to her for half the amount he wanted, and I doubt he realized what had happened until he was nearly back home, if then. He sent her a moonstone bracelet later. Domani women don't deserve the whole reputation they have. Stiff-necked prigs, going by hearsay, built most of it, but we have earned some. My mother and my aunts taught me, along with my sisters and cousins, of course. Looking down at herself, she shook her head, then returned to her ministrations with a sigh. But I fear I was as tall as I am today on my 14th naming day, all knees and elbows like a colt that grew too fast. And not long after I could walk across a room without tripping twice, I learned... She drew a deep breath. Learned my life would take me another way than being a merchant. And now that is gone, too. About time I put to use what I was taught all those years ago. Under the circumstances, I can't think of a better time or place. Swan studied her shrewdly a moment more. That isn't the reason. Not the whole reason. Out with it. Hurling a small brush into the box, Liana blazed up in a fury. The whole reason? I do not know the whole reason. I only know I need something in my life to replace what is gone. You yourself told me that is the only hope of surviving. Revenge falls short for me. I know your cause is necessary and perhaps even right, but the light helped me that is not enough either. I can't make myself be as involved as you. Maybe I came too late to it. I will stay with you, but it isn't enough. Anger faded as she began resealing pots and vials and replacing them, though she used more force than was strictly necessary. There was the merest hint of rose scent about her. I know flirting isn't something to fill up the emptiness, but it is enough to fill an idle moment. Maybe being who I was born to be will suffice. I just do not know. This isn't a new idea. I always wanted to be like my mother and my aunts, daydreamed of it sometimes after I was grown. Liana's face became pensive, and the last things went into the box more gently. I think perhaps I've always felt I was masquerading as someone else, building up a mask until it became second nature. There was serious work to be done, more serious than merchanting, and by the time I realized there was another way I could have gone, even so, I had the mask on too firmly to take off. Well, that is done with now, and the mask is coming off. I even considered beginning with Loghain a week ago for practice, but I am out of practice, and I think he is the kind of man who might hear more promises than you meant to offer, and expect to have them fulfilled. A small smile suddenly appeared on her lips. My mother always said, if that happened, you had miscalculated badly. If there was no back way out, you had to either abandon dignity and run, or pay the price and consider it a lesson. The smile took on a roguish cast. My Aunt Rissara said you paid the price and enjoyed it. Min could only shake her head. It was as if Liana had become a different woman, talking that way about... Even hearing it, she could hardly believe. Come to that, Liana actually looked different. For all of the work with brushes, there was not a hint of paint or powder on her face that men could see, yet her lips seemed fuller, her cheekbones higher, her eyes larger. She was a more than pretty woman at any time, but now her beauty was magnified fivefold. Swan was not quite finished, though. "And if this country lord is one like Loghain," she said softly, "what will you do then?" Liana drew herself up, stiff-backed, on her knees, and swallowed hard before answering, but her voice was perfectly level. "Given the alternatives, what choice would you make?" Neither blinked, and the silence stretched. Before Swan could answer it, if she meant to, Min would have given a pretty to hear it. The chain and lock rattled on the other side of the door. The other two women got slowly to their feet, gathering their saddlebags in calm preparation, but Min leaped up, wishing she had her belt knife. "Fool thing to wish for," she thought. "Just get me in worse trouble. I'm no bloody hero in a story. Even if I jumped the guard..." The door opened, and a man with a long leather jerkin over his shirt filled the doorway. Not a fellow to be attacked by a young woman, even with a knife. Maybe not even with an axe. Wide was the word for him, and thick. The few hairs remaining on his head were more white than not, but he looked hard as an old oak stump.
"Time for you girls to stand before the Lord," he said gruffly. "Will you walk, or must we haul you like grain sacks? You go either way, but I'd as soon not have to carry you in this heat."
Peeking past him, Min saw two more men waiting, gray-haired but just as hard, if not quite so big.
"We will walk," Swan told him dryly. "Good. Come then. Step along. Lord Gareth won't like being kept waiting."
Promised to walk or no, each man took one of them firmly by the arm as they started up the dusty dirt street. The balding man's hand encircled Min's arm like a manacle. So much for running for it, she thought bitterly. She considered kicking his booted ankle to see if that would loosen his grip, but he looked so solid she suspected all it would earn her was a sore toe and being dragged the rest of the way. Liana appeared lost in thought. She half made small gestures with her free hand, and her lips moved silently as though reviewing what she meant to say, but she kept shaking her head and starting over again. Introspection wrapped Swan, too, but she wore an openly worried frown, even chewing her underlip. Swan never showed that much unease. All in all, the pair of them did nothing for Min's confidence. The beam-ceilinged common room of the good queen's justice did less. Lank-haired Admir Nem, a yellowed bruise around his swollen eye, stood to one side, with half a dozen equally stout brothers and cousins and their wives, all in their best coats or aprons. The farmers eyed the three prisoners with a mixture of anger and satisfaction that made Min's stomach sink. If anything, the farm wives' glares were worse, pure hate. The rest of the walls were lined six deep with villagers, all garbed for the work they had interrupted for this. The blacksmith still wore his leather apron, and a number of women had sleeves rolled up, arms dusted with flour. The room buzzed with their murmuring among themselves, the elders as much as the few children, and their eyes latched onto the three women as avidly as the Nems did. Min thought this must be as much excitement as Cor Springs had ever witnessed. She had seen a crowd with this mood once, at an execution. The tables had been removed, except for one placed in front of the long brick fireplace. A bluff-faced, stocky man, his hair thick with gray, sat facing them in a well-cut coat of dark green silk, hands folded in front of him on the tabletop. A slim woman who showed as much age stood beside the table in a fine gray wool dress, embroidered with white flowers around the neck. The local lord, Min supposed, and his lady. Country nobility, little better informed of the world than their tenants and crofters. The guards situated them in front of the lord's table and melted into the watchers. The woman in gray stepped forward, and the murmurs died. All here attend and give ear, the woman announced, for justice will be meted today by Lord Gareth Bryn. Prisoners, you are called before the judgment of Lord Bryn. Not the Lord's lady, then, an official of some sort. Gareth Bryn? The last men remembered, he was Captain General of the Queen's Guards in Camelin, if it was the same man. She glanced at Swan, but Swan had her eyes locked on the wide floorboards in front of her feet. Whoever he was, this Bryn looked weary. "You are charged," the woman in gray went on, "with trespass by night, arson and destruction of a building and its contents, the killing of valuable livestock, assault on the person of Admiral Nem, and the theft of a purse said to contain gold and silver. It is understood that the assault and theft were the work of your companion who escaped, but you three are equally culpable under the law." She paused to let it sink in, and men exchanged rueful glances with Lyanna. Loghain would have to add theft to the stew. He was probably halfway to Mirandy by now, if not more distant yet. After a moment, the woman began again. "Your accusers are here to face you." She gestured to the cluster of Nems. "Admiral Nem, you will give your testimony." The stout man eased forward in a blend of self-importance and self-consciousness, tugging at his coat where the wooden buttons strained over his middle, running his hands through thinning hair that kept dropping into his face.
"Like I said, Lord Gareth, it was like this."
He gave a fairly straightforward account of discovering them in the hayloft and ordering them out, though he made Loghain near a foot taller and turned the man's single blow into a fight where Nem gave as good as he got. The lantern fell, the hay went up, and the rest of the family came spilling out of the farmhouse into the pre-dawn. The prisoners were seized and the barn burned to the ground, and then the loss of the purse from the house was discovered. He did slight the part where Lord Bryn's retainer rode by as some of the family were bringing out ropes and eyeing tree limbs. When he started on the fight again, this time he seemed to be winning, Bryn cut him off. "That will be enough, Master Nem. You may step back." Instead, a round-faced one of the Nem women, of an age to be Admiral's wife, joined him. Round-faced, but not soft, round like a frying pan or a river rock, and flushed with something more than anger.
"You whip these hussies good, Lord Gareth here. Whip them good, and ride them to Jornhill on a rail."
"No one called on you to speak, Maegan," the slim woman in gray said sharply. "This is a trial, not a petition meeting. You and Admiral step back, now." They obeyed, Admiral with a shade more alacrity than Maegan. The gray-clad woman turned to Min and her companions. "If you wish to offer testimony in defense or mitigation, you may now give it." There was no sympathy in her voice, nor anything else for that matter. Min expected Swan to speak. She always took the lead, did the talking. But Swan never stirred or raised her eyes. Instead, it was Lyanna who moved toward the table, her eyes on the man behind it. She stood as straight as ever, but her usual walk, a graceful stride, but a stride, had become a sort of glide, with just a hint of willowy sway to it. Somehow her hips and bosom seemed more obvious. Not that she flaunted anything. The way she moved just made you aware.
"My lord, we are three helpless women, refugees from the storms that sweep the world."
Her usually brisk tones were gone, changed to a velvety soft caress. There was a light in her dark eyes, a sort of smoldering challenge.
"Penniless and lost, we took shelter in Master Nem's barn. It was wrong, I know, but we were afraid of the night."
A small gesture, hands half raised, the insides of her wrists to Bryn, made her seem for a moment utterly helpless. Only for that moment, though.
"The man, Dalin, was a stranger to us, really, a man who offered us his protection. In these days, women alone must have a protector, my lord, yet I fear we made a poor choice."
A widening of the eyes, an entreating look, said he could make a better for them.
"It was indeed he who attacked Master Nem, my lord. We would have fled, or worked, to repay our night's lodging."
Stepping around the side of the table, she knelt gracefully beside Bryn's chair and gently rested the fingers of one hand on his wrist as she gazed up into his eyes. A tremble touched her voice, but her slight smile was enough to set any man's heart racing. It suggested, "My lord, we are guilty of some small crime, yet not so much as we are charged with. We throw ourselves on your mercy. I beg you, my lord, have pity on us and protect us." For a long moment, Bryn stared back into her eyes. Then, clearing his throat roughly, he scraped back his chair, rose, and walked around the opposite end of the table from her. There was a stir among the villagers and farmers, men clearing their throats as their lord had done, women muttering under their breath. Bryn stopped in front of Min.
"What is your name, girl?"
"Min, my lord." She caught a muffled grunt from Swan and hastily added, "Serenla, Min. Everyone calls me Serenla, my lord." "Your mother must have had a premonition," he murmured with a smile. He was not the first to react to the name in a like way.
"Do you have any statement to make, Serenla?"
"Only that I am very sorry, my lord, and it really wasn't our fault. Dalin did it all. I ask for mercy, my lord." That did not seem much alongside Lyanna's plea. Anything at all would seem insignificant beside Lyanna's performance, but it was the best she could find. Her mouth was as dry as the street outside. What if he did decide to hang them? Nodding, he moved over to Swan, who was still studying the floor. Cupping a hand under her chin, he raised her eyes to his.
"And what is your name, girl?"
With a jerk of her head, Swan pulled her chin free and took a step back. "Mara, my lord," she whispered. "Mara Tomanes." Min groaned softly. Swan was plainly frightened, yet at the same time she stared at the man defiantly. Min more than half expected her to demand Bryn to let them walk away on the instant. He asked her if she wished to make a statement, and she denied it in another unsteady whisper, but all the while looking at him as though she were the one in charge. She might be controlling her tongue, but certainly not her eyes. After a time, Bryn turned away.
"Take your place with your friends, girl," he told Lyanna as he returned to his chair.
She joined them with a look of open frustration and what in anyone else Min would have called a touch of petulance.
"I have reached my decision," Bryn said to the room at large. "The crimes are serious, and nothing I have heard alters the facts. If three men sneak into another's house to steal his candlesticks, and one of them attacks the owner, all three are equally guilty. There must be recompense. Master Nem, I will give you the cost of rebuilding your barn, plus the price of 6 milk cows."
The stout farmer's eyes brightened until Bryn added, "Carolyn will disperse the coin to you when she is content as to costs and prices. Some of your cows were going dry, I hear." The slim woman in gray nodded in satisfaction. "For the bump on your head, I award you 1 silver mark. Don't complain," he said firmly as Nem opened his mouth. "Maigan has given you worse for drinking too much." A ripple of laughter among the onlookers greeted that, not diminished at all by Nem's half-abashed glares, and perhaps spurred by the tight-lipped look Maigan gave her husband. "I will also replace the amount of the stolen purse, once Carolyn has satisfied herself as to how much was in it." Nem and his wife appeared equally disgruntled, but they held their tongues. It was plain he had given them what he would. Min began to feel hope. Leaning his elbows on the table, Bryn turned his attention to her and the other two. His slow words tied her stomach into a knot. "You three will work for me, at the normal wages for whatever tasks you are given, until the coin I've paid out is repaid to me. Do not think I am being lenient. If you swear an oath that satisfies me you don't have to be guarded, you can work in my manor. If not, it's the fields, where you can be under someone's eyes every minute. Wages are lower in the fields, but it is your decision." Frantically, she racked her brain for the weakest oath that might satisfy. She did not like breaking her word in any circumstances, but she meant to be gone as soon as a chance presented, and she did not want too heavy an oath-breaking on her conscience. Lyanna seemed to be searching, too, but Swan barely hesitated before kneeling and folding her hands over her heart. Her eyes seemed fastened to Bryn's, and the challenge had not faded one bit. "By the light and my hope of salvation and rebirth, I swear to serve you in whatever way you require for as long as you require. Or may the Creator's face turn from me forever, and darkness consume my soul." She delivered the words in a breathy whisper, but they created a dead silence. There was no oath stronger, unless it was the one a woman took on being made Aes Sedai, and the oath rod bound her to that as surely as to a part of her flesh. Lyanna stared at Swan, then she was on her knees, too. "By the light and my hope of salvation and rebirth..." Min floundered desperately, searching for some way out. Swearing a lesser oath than they did meant the fields for certain, and someone watching her every instant. But this oath! By what she had been taught, breaking it would be not much less than murder, maybe no less. Only there was no way out. The oath, or who knew how many years laboring in a field all day and probably locked up at night. Sinking down beside the other two women, she muttered the words, but inside she was howling. "Swan, you utter fool! What have you gotten me into now? I can't stay here. I have to go to Rand. Oh, light, help me." "Well," Bryn breathed, when the last word was spoken, "I did not expect that, but it does suffice. Carolyn, would you take Master Nem somewhere and find out what he thinks his losses amount to? And clear everyone else but these three out of here, too, and make arrangements to transport them to the manor. Under the circumstances, I don't think guards will be necessary." The slim woman gave him a harassed look, but in short order she had everyone moving out in a milling throng. Admiral Nem and his male kin stuck close to her, his face especially painted with avarice. The Nem women looked scarcely less greedy, but they still spared a few hard glowers for Min and the other two, who remained kneeling as the room emptied out. For herself, Min did not believe her legs could hold her up. The same phrases repeated over and over in her mind. "Oh, Swan, why? I can't stay here. I can't!" "We have had a few refugees through here," Bryn said when the last of the villagers had gone. He leaned back in his chair, studying them. "But never as odd a threesome as you. A Damani." "A Tyran?" Swan nodded curtly. She and Lyanna stood up, the slender, coppery-skinned woman delicately brushing her knees, Swan simply standing. Min managed to join them on wobbly legs. "And you, Serenla." Once more he gave the ghost of a smile at the name. "Somewhere in the west of Andor, unless I mistake your accent." "Baerlon," she muttered, then bit her tongue too late. Someone might know Min was from Baerlon. "I've heard of nothing in the west to make you refugees," he said in a questioning tone. When she remained silent, he did not press it. "After you have worked off your debt, you will be welcome to remain in my service. Life can be hard for those who've lost their homes, and even a maid's cot is better than sleeping under a bush."
"Thank you, my lord,"
Lyanna said caressingly, making a curtsy so graceful that even in her rough riding dress it looked part of a dance. Min's echo was leaden, and she did not trust her knees for a curtsy. Swan simply stood there staring at him and said nothing at all. "A pity your companion took your horses. Four horses would reduce your debt by some."
"He was a stranger and a rogue," Lyanna told him, in a voice suitable for something far more intimate. "I, for one, am more than happy to exchange his protection for yours, my lord."
Bryn eyed her, appreciatively, Min thought, but all he said was, "At least you will be safely away from the Nems at the manor." There was no reply for that. Min supposed scrubbing floors in Bryn's manor would not be much different from scrubbing floors in the Nem farmhouse. "How do I get out of this? Light, how?" The silence went on, except for Bryn drumming his fingers on the table. Min would have thought he was at a loss for what to say next, but she did not think this man was ever off balance.
More likely he was irritated that only Lyanna appeared to be showing any gratitude. She supposed their sentence could have been much worse, from his point of view. Perhaps Lyanna's heated glances and stroking tones had worked after a fashion, but Min found herself wishing the woman had remained the way she was. Being hung up by the wrists in the village square would be better than this. Finally, Carolyn returned, muttering to herself. She sounded prickly, reporting to Bryn. It will take days to get straight answers from those Nems, Lord Garroth. Admir would have 5 new barns and 50 cows if I let him. At least I believe there really was a purse, but as to how much was in it... She shook her head and sighed. I will find out eventually. Joni is ready to take these girls to the manor if you are done with them. Take them away, Carolyn, Bryn said, rising. When you've sent them off, join me at the brickyard. He sounded weary again. Thad Heron says he needs more water if he's to keep making bricks, and the light alone knows where I will find it for him. He strode out of the common room as if he had forgotten all about the 3 women who had just sworn to serve him. Joni turned out to be the wide, balding man who had come for them in the shed, waiting now in front of the inn beside a high-wheeled cart, enclosed by a round canvas cover, with a lean brown horse in the shafts. A few of the villagers stood about to watch their departure, but most seemed to have gone back to their homes and out of the heat. Garroth Bryn was already far down the dirt street. "Joni will see you safely to the manor," Carolyn said. "Do as you are told, and you will not find the life hard." For a moment she considered them, dark eyes nearly as sharp as swans. Then she nodded to herself, as if satisfied, and hurried off after Bryn. Joni held the curtains open for them at the back of the cart, but let them clamber up unaided and find places to sit on the cart bed. There was not so much as a handful of straw for padding, and the heavy covering trapped the heat. He said not a word. The cart rocked as he climbed up on the driver's seat, hidden by the canvas. Min heard him cluck to the horse, and the cart lurched off, wheels creaking slightly, bumping over occasional potholes. There was just enough of a crack in the covering at the back for Min to watch the village dwindle behind them and vanish, replaced alternately by long thickets and rail-fenced fields. She felt too stunned to speak. Swan's grand cause was to end scrubbing pots and floors. She should never have helped the woman, never stayed with her. She should have ridden for Tyr at the first opportunity. "Well," Lyanna said suddenly, "that worked out not badly at all." She was back to her usual brisk voice again, but there was a flush of excitement in it, and a high color in her cheeks. "It could have been better, but practice will take care of that." Her low laugh was almost a giggle. "I never realized how much fun it could be, when I actually felt his pulse racing." For a moment she held out her hand the way she had placed it on Bryn's wrist. "I don't think I ever felt so alive, so aware. Aunt Rosara used to say men were better sport than hawks, but I never really understood until today." Holding herself against the sway of the cart, Min goggled at her. "You have gone mad," she said finally. "How many years have we sworn away? 2? 5? I suppose you hope Garroth Bryn will spend them dandling you on his knee. Well, I hope he turns you over it. Every day." The startled look on Lyanna's face did nothing for Min's temper. Did she expect Min to take it as calmly as she appeared to? But it was not Lyanna that Min was really angry with. She twisted around to glare at Swan. "And you! When you decide to give up, you don't do it small. You just surrender like a lamb at slaughter. Why did you choose that oath? Light, why?" "Because," Swan replied, "it was the one oath I could be sure would keep him from setting people to watch us night and day, manor house or not." Lying half stretched out on the rough planks of the cart, she made it sound the most obvious thing in the world, and Lyanna appeared to agree with her. "You mean to break it?" Min said after a moment. It came out in a shocked whisper, but even so she glanced worriedly at the canvas curtains that hid Joni. She did not think he could have heard. "I mean to do what I must," Swan said firmly, but just as softly. "In 2 or 3 days, when I can be sure they really aren't watching us especially, we will leave. I fear we must take horses, since ours are gone. Bryn must have good stables. I will regret that. And Lyanna just sat there like a cat with cream on her whiskers. She must have realized from the first that was why she had not hesitated in swearing. "You will regret stealing horses?" Min said hoarsely. "You plan to break an oath anyone but a dark friend would keep, and you regret stealing horses? I can't believe either of you. I don't know either of you." "Do you really mean to stay and scrub pots?" Lyanna asked, her voice just as low as theirs, "when Rand is out there with your heart in his pocket?" Min glowered silently. She wished they had never learned she was in love with Randall Thor. Sometimes she wished she had never learned it. A man who barely knew she was alive, a man like that. What he was no longer seemed as important as the fact that he had never looked at her twice, but it was all of a piece, really. She wanted to say she would keep her oath, forget about Rand for however long it took her to work off her debt. Only she could not open her mouth. Burn him. If I'd never met him, I wouldn't be in this pickle. When the silence between them had gone on far too long for Min's liking, broken only by the rhythmic creak of the wheels and the soft thud of the horse's hooves, Swan spoke. "I mean to do as I swore to do, when I have finished what I must do first. I did not swear to serve him immediately. I was careful not to even imply it, strictly speaking. A fine point, I know, and one Gareth Bryn might not appreciate, but true all the same." Min sagged in amazement, letting herself lurch with the cart's slow motion. "You intend to run away? Then come back in a few years and hand yourselves over to Bryn? The man will sell your hides to a tannery. Our hides!" Not until she said that did she realize she had accepted Swan's solution. Run away, then come back, and... "I can't. I love Rand, and he wouldn't notice if Gareth Bryn made me work in his kitchens the rest of my life." "Not a man to cross, I agree," Swan sighed. "I met him once, before. I was terrified he might recognize my voice today. Faces may change, but voices don't." She touched her own face wonderingly, as she sometimes did, apparently unaware of doing so. "Faces do change," she murmured. Then her tone firmed. "I've paid heavy prices already for what I had to do, and I will pay this one, eventually. If you must drown or ride a lionfish, you ride and hope for the best. That is all there is to it, Serenla." "Being a servant is far from the future I would choose," Lyanna said. "But it is in the future, and who knows what may happen before. I can remember too well when I thought I had no future." A small smile appeared on her lips, her eyes half closed dreamily, and her voice became velvet. "Besides, I don't think he will sell our hides at all. Give me a few years of practice, and then a few minutes with Lord Gareth Bryn, and he will greet us with open arms and put us up in his best rooms. He'll deck us with silks and offer his carriage to carry us wherever we want to go." Min left her wrapped in her fantasy. Sometimes she thought the other two both lived in dream worlds. Something else occurred to her, a small thing, but it was beginning to irritate. Mara, tell me something. I've noticed some people smile when you call me by name. Serenla. Bryn did, and he said something about my mother having a premonition. Why?" "In the old tongue," Swan replied, "it means stubborn daughter. You did have a stubborn streak when we first met, a mile wide and a mile deep." "Swan said that! Swan, the most stubborn woman in the whole world!" Her smile was as wide as her face. "Of course, you do seem to be coming along. At the next village, you might use Chalinda, that means sweet girl, or maybe..." Suddenly the cart gave a harder lurch than any before, then picked up speed as if the horse were reaching for a gallop. Bumping around like grain on a chaffing sieve, the three women stared at one another in surprise. Then Swan levered herself up and pulled aside the canvas hiding the driver's seat. Joni was gone. Throwing herself across the wooden seat, Swan grabbed the reins and reared back, hauling the horse to a halt. Min threw open the back curtains, searching. The road ran through a thicket here, nearly a small forest of oak and elm, pine and leather leaf. The dust of their short dash was still settling, some of it on Joni, where he lay sprawled by the side of the hard-packed dirt road, 60 or so paces back. Instinctively, Min leaped down and ran back to kneel beside the big man. He was still breathing, but his eyes were closed, and a bloody gash on the side of his head was coming up in a purple lump. Liana pushed her aside and felt Joni's head with sure fingers. "He will live," she said crisply. "Nothing seems broken, but he will have a headache for days after he wakes." Sitting back on her heels, she folded her hands, and her voice saddened. "There is nothing I can do for him in any case. Burn me. I promised myself I would not cry over it again." "The question..." Min swallowed and started again. "The question is, do we load him in the back of the cart and take him on to the manor, or do we... go? Light, I'm no better than Swan." "We could carry him as far as the next farm," Liana said slowly. Swan came up to them, leading the cart horse as if afraid the placid animal might bite. One glance at the man on the ground and she frowned. "He never had that falling off the cart. I don't see root or rock here to cause it." She started studying the wood around them, and a man rode out of the trees on a tall black stallion, leading three mares, one shaggy and two hands shorter than the others. He was a tall man in a blue silk coat, with a sword at his side, his hair curling to broad shoulders, darkly handsome despite a hardening, as though misfortune had marked him deeply. And he was the last man Min expected to see. "Is this your work?" Swan demanded of him. Loghain smiled as he reined in beside the cart, though there was little amusement in it. "A sling is a useful thing, Mara. You are lucky I am here. I didn't expect you to leave the village for some hours yet, and barely able to walk then. The local lord was indulgent, it seems." Abruptly his face went even darker, and his voice was rough stone. "Did you think I would leave you to your fate? Maybe I should have. You made promises to me, Mara. I want the revenge you promised. I've followed you halfway to the Sea of Storms on this search, though you won't tell me what for. I've asked no questions as to how you planned to give me what you promised, but I will tell you this now. Your time is growing short. End your search soon and deliver your promises, or I will leave you to find your own way. You'll quickly find most villages offer small sympathy to penniless strangers. Three pretty women alone? The sight of this," he touched the sword at his hip, "has kept you safe more times than you can know. Find what you are seeking soon, Mara." He had not been so arrogant at the beginning of their journey. Then he had been humbly thankful for their help, as humbly as a man like Loghain could manage, anyway. It seemed that time, and a lack of results, had withered his gratitude. Swan did not flinch away from his stare. "I hope to," she said firmly. "But if you want to go, then leave our horses and go. If you won't row, get out of the boat and swim by yourself. See how far you get with your revenge alone." Loghain's big hands tightened on his reins until Men heard his knuckles crack. He shivered with emotions in strong check. "I will stay a while longer, Mara," he said finally. "A little while longer." For an instant, to Min's eyes, a halo flared around his head, a radiant crown of gold and blue. Swan and Liana saw nothing, of course, though they knew what she could do. Sometimes she saw things about people, viewings, she called them, images or auras. Sometimes she knew what they meant. That woman would marry. That man would die. Small matters or grand events, joyous or bleak, there was never any rhyme or reason to who or where or when. Aes Sedai and warders always had auras. Most people never did. It was not always pleasant, knowing. She had seen Loghain's halo before, and she knew what it meant. Glory to come. But for him, perhaps above all men, surely that made no sense at all. His horse and his sword and his coat had come from playing at dice, though Min was not certain how fair the games had been. He had nothing else, and no prospects except Swan's promises, and how could Swan ever keep them? His very name was likely a death sentence. It just made no sense. Loghain's humor returned as suddenly as it had gone. Pulling a fat, roughly woven purse from his belt, he jangled it at them.
"I've come by a few coins. We won't have to sleep in another barn for a while."
"We heard of it," Swan said dryly. "I suppose I should have expected no better from you. Think of it as a contribution to your search." She stretched out her hand, but he tied the purse back to his belt with a faintly mocking grin. "I would not want to taint your hand with stolen coin, Mara. Besides, this way, perhaps I can be sure you won't run off and leave me." Swan looked as if she could have bitten a nail in two, but she said nothing. Standing in his stirrups, Loghain peered down the road toward Core Springs. "I see a flock of sheep coming this way and a pair of boys. Time for us to ride. They'll carry word of this as fast as they can run." Settling back down, he glanced at Joni, still lying there unconscious. "And they'll fetch help for that fellow. I don't think I hit him hard enough to hurt him badly." Min shook her head. The man continually surprised her. She would not have thought he would spare a second thought for a man whose head he had just cracked. Swan and Liana wasted no time scrambling into their high-cantled saddles, Liana onto the gray mare she called Moonflower, Swan onto Bella, the short, shaggy mare. It was more of a scramble for Swan. She was no horsewoman. After weeks in the saddle, she still treated sedate Bella like a fiery-eyed warhorse. Liana handled Moonflower with effortless ease. Men knew she was somewhere in between. She climbed onto Wild Rose, her bay, with considerably more grace than Swan, considerably less than Liana.
"Do you think he will come after us?" Min asked as they started south, away from Core Springs, at a trot. She meant the question for Swan, but it was Loghain who answered.
"The local lord? I doubt he thinks you important enough. Of course he may send a man, and he'll certainly spread your descriptions. We will ride as far as we can manage before stopping, and again tomorrow."
It seemed he was taking charge.
"We aren't important enough," Swan said, bouncing awkwardly in her saddle. She might have been wary of Bella, but the look she directed at Loghain's back said his challenge to her authority would not last long. For herself, Min hoped Bryn considered them unimportant. He probably did. As long as he never learned their real names. Loghain quickened the stallion's pace, and she heeled Wild Rose to keep up, putting her thoughts ahead, not behind.
Tucking his leather gauntlets behind his sword belt, Garth Bryn picked up the curl-brimmed velvet hat from his writing table. The hat was the latest fashion from Camelin. Carlin had seen to that. He had no care for fashion, but she thought he should dress suitably for his position, and it was the silks and velvets she laid out for him in the mornings. As he set the high-crowned hat on his head, he caught sight of his shadowy reflection in one of the study windows. Fitting that it was so wavery and thin. Squint as much as he would, his gray hat and gray silk coat, embroidered with silver scrolls down the sleeves and collar, looked nothing like the helmet and armor he was used to. That was over and done. And this? This was something to fill empty hours, that was all.
"Are you certain you want to do this, Lord Garth?"
He turned from the window to where Carlin stood beside her own writing table, across the room from his. Hers was piled with the estate account books. She had run his estates all the years he had been gone, and without doubt she still made a better job of it than he did.
"If you had set them to work for Admiral Nem, as the law required," she went on, "this would be none of your affair at all."
"But I did not," he told her, "and would not if I had it to do again. You know as well as I do, Nem and his male kin would be trying to corner those girls day and night. And Maegan and the rest of the women would make their lives the pit of doom. That is, if all three girls didn't accidentally fall down a well and drown."
"Even Maegan would not use a well," Carlin said dryly, "not with the weather we've been having. Still, I take your point, Lord Garth. but they must have had most of a day and a night to run in any direction. You will locate them as soon by sending out word of them, if they can be found.
Thad can find them.
Thad was over 70, but he could still track yesterday's wind across stone by moonlight, and he had been more than happy to turn the brickyard over to his son.
If you say so, Lord Gareth.
She and Thad did not get on.
Well, when you bring them back, I can certainly use them in the house.
Something in her voice, casual as it was, pricked his attention. A touch of satisfaction. Practically from the day he arrived home, Carlin had introduced a succession of pretty maids and farm girls into the manor house, all willing and eager to help the Lord forget his miseries.
They are oath-breakers, Carlin. I fear it's the fields for them.
A brief, exasperated tightening of her lips confirmed his suspicions, but she kept her tone indifferent.
The other two, perhaps, Lord Gareth, but the Domani girl's grace would be wasted in the fields, and would suit serving at table very well. A remarkably pretty young woman. Still, it will be as you wish, of course.
So that was the one Carlin had picked out. A remarkably pretty young woman indeed, though oddly different from the Domani women he had met. A touch hesitant here, a touch too fast there. Almost as if she were just now trying out her arts for the first time. That was impossible, of course. Domani women trained their daughters to twine men around their fingers almost from the cradle. Not that she had been ineffective, he admitted. If Carlin had sprung her on him among the farm girls, remarkably pretty. So why was it not her face that kept filling his mind? Why did he find himself thinking of a pair of blue eyes, challenging him as though wishing she had a sword, afraid and refusing to yield to fear? Mara Tomanis. He had been sure she was one to keep her word, even without oaths.
I will bring her back, he muttered to himself. I will know why she broke oath.
As you say, my lord, Carolyn said. I thought she might do for your bedchamber maid. Sela is getting a bit old to be running up and down the stairs to fetch for you at night.
Bryn blinked at her.
What?
Oh, the Domani girl. He shook his head at Carolyn's foolishness.
But was he being any less foolish?
He was the lord here. He should remain here to take care of his people. Yet Carlin had taken better care than he knew how, all the years he was gone. He knew camps and soldiers and campaigns, and maybe a bit of how to maneuver in court intrigues. She was right. He should take off his sword and this fool hat, and have Carlin write out their descriptions, and... Instead, he said, "Keep a close eye on Admiral Nem and his kin. They'll try to cheat you as much as they can."
"As you say, my lord."
The words were perfectly respectful. The tone told him to go teach his grandfather to shear sheep. Chuckling to himself, he went outside. The manor house was really little more than a tremendously overgrown farmhouse, two rambling stories of brick and stone under a slate roof, added to again and again by generations of Bryns. House Bryn had owned this land, or it had owned them, since Andor was wrought from the wreckage of Arthur Hawkwing's empire 1,000 years before. And for all that time, it had sent its sons off to fight Andor's wars. He would fight no more wars, but it was too late for House Bryn. There had been too many years, too many battles. He was the last of the blood. No wife, no son, no daughter. The line ended with... All things had to end. The wheel of time turned. 20 men waited beside saddled horses on the stone-paved yard in front of the manor house. Men even grayer than he, mostly, if they had hair. Experienced soldiers all, former squad men, squadron leaders, and bannermen who had served with him at one time or another in his career. Johnny Chagrin, who had been senior bannerman of the guards, was right at the front with a bandage around his temples, though Bryn knew for a fact his daughters had set their children to keep him in his bed. He was one of the few who had any family, here or anywhere else. Most had chosen to come serve Garth Brynn again, rather than drink away their pensions over reminiscences no one but another old soldier wanted to hear. All wore swords belted over their coats, and a few carried long steel-tipped lances that hung for years on a wall until this very morning. Every saddle had a fat blanket roll behind and bulging saddlebags, plus a pot or kettle and full water bags, just as if they were riding out on campaign instead of a week's jaunt to chase down three women who set fire to a barn. Here was a chance to relive old days, or pretend to. He wondered if that was what was rousting him out. He was certainly too old to go riding off after a set of pretty eyes and a woman young enough to be his daughter. Maybe his granddaughter. I am not that big a fool, he told himself firmly. Carlin could manage things better with him not getting in the way. A lanky bay gelding came galloping up the oak lane that led down to the road, and the rider threw himself out of the saddle before the animal came to a full stop. The man half stumbled, but still managed to put fist to heart in a proper salute. Barim Hala, who served under him as a senior squadman years ago, was hard and wiry, with a leather egg for a head and white eyebrows that seemed to be trying to make up for the lack of other hair. "You've been recalled to Camelin, my captain general?" he panted. "No," Brynn said, too sharply. "What do you mean riding in here as though you had carrion and cavalry on your tail?" Some of the other horses were frisking, catching the bay's mood. "Never rode that hard unless we was chasing them, my lord." Barim's grin faded when the man saw he was not laughing. "Well, my lord, I seen the horses, and I reckoned—" The man took another look at his face and cut off that line. "Well, actually, I got some news, too. I've been over to New Braham to see my sister, and I heard plenty." New Braham was older than Andor. Old Braham had been destroyed in the Trolloc Wars 1,000 years before Arthur Hawkwing, and it was a good place for news. A middling-sized border town, well to the east of his estates, on the road from Camelin to Tarvalin. Even with Morghese's current attitude, the merchants would keep that road busy.
"Well, out with it, man. If there's news, what is it?"
Just trying to figure where to start, my lord."
Barim straightened unconsciously, as though making a report.
"Most important, I reckon. They say Tyr has fallen. Aielman took the stone itself, and the sword that cannot be touched has flat been touched. Somebody drew it, they say."
"An Aiel drew it," Brynn said incredulously.
An Aiel would die before he touched a sword. He had seen it happen in the Aiel War. Though it was said Kalandor was not really a sword at all, whatever that meant.
"They didn't say, my lord. I heard names. Wren, somebody or other, most often. But they was talking it like fact, not rumor. Like everybody knew."
Brynn's forehead creased in a frown. Worse than troubling, if true. If Kalandor had been drawn, then the dragon was reborn. According to the prophecies, that meant the last battle was coming, the Dark One breaking free. The dragon reborn would save the world, so the prophecies said, and destroy it. This was news enough by itself to have set Hala galloping, if he had thought twice. But the leathery fellow was not finished.
"Word come down from Tarvalin is near as big, my lord. They say there's a new Amarlin seat. Elida, my lord, who was the queen's advisor."
Blinking suddenly, Hala hurried on. Morghese was forbidden ground, and every man on the estate knew it, though Brynn had never said so.
"They say the old Amarlin, Swan Sanche, was stilled and executed, and Loghain died too, that false dragon they caught in Gentle last year. They talked it like it was true, my lord. Some of them claimed they was in Tarvalin when it all happened."
Loghain was no great news, even if he had started a war in Giladon by claiming to be the dragon reborn. There had been several false dragons the last few years. He could channel, though. That was a fact. Until the Aes Sedai gentled him. Well, he was not the first man to be caught and gentled, cut off from the power so he could never channel again. They said men like that, whether false dragons or just poor fools the Red Aja took against, never lived long. It was said they gave up wanting to live. Swan Sanche, though, that was news. He had met her once, nearly 3 years ago. A woman who demanded obedience and gave no reasons. Tough as an old boot, with a tongue like a file and a temper like that of a bear with a sore tooth. He would have expected her to tear any upstart claimant limb from limb with her bare hands. Stilling was the same as gentling for a man, but more rare by far, especially for an Ammerlin seat. Only 2 Ammerlins in 3,000 years had suffered that fate, so far as the tower admitted, though it was possible they could have hidden 2 dozen more. The tower was very good at hiding what they wanted hidden. But an execution on top of Stilling seemed unnecessary. It was said women survived Stilling no better than men did gentling. It all stank of trouble. Everyone knew the tower had secret alliances, strings tied to thrones and powerful lords and ladies. With a new Ammerlin raised in this fashion, some would surely try to test whether the Aes Sedai still watched as closely. And once this fellow in Tyr quelled any opposition, not that there was likely to be much if he really did have the stone, he would move against Ilion or Cairhien. The question was, how quickly could he move? Would forces be gathered against him, or for him? He had to be the true dragon reborn, but the houses would go both ways, and the people too. And if petty squabbles broke out because the tower...
"Old fool," he muttered.
Seeing Barham give a start, he added,
"Not you, another old fool."
None of this was his affair any longer, except to decide which way House Bryn went when the time came. Not that anyone would care, except to know whether or not to attack him. Bryn had never been a powerful house, or large.
My lord,
Barham glanced at the men waiting with their horses.
Do you think you might need me, my lord?
Without even asking where or why. He was not the only one bored with country life.
Catch up to us when you have your gear together. We'll be heading south on the Four Kings Road to start.
Barham saluted and dashed away, dragging his horse behind him. Climbing into his saddle, Bryn swung his arm forward without a word, and the men fell into a column of 2s behind him as they headed down the oak lane. He meant to have answers. If he had to take this Mara by the scruff of the neck and shake her, he would have answers.
The High Lady Altima relaxed as the gates of the royal palace of Andor swung open and her carriage rolled in. She had not been certain they would open. It had surely taken long enough to get a note taken in, and longer still to have a reply. Her maid, a thin girl acquired here in Camelin, goggled and all but bounced on the seat across from her at the excitement of actually entering the palace. Snapping open her lace fan, Altima tried to cool herself. It was still well short of midday. The heat would grow worse yet. To think she had always thought of Andor as cool. Hastily she reviewed what she meant to say one last time. She was a pretty woman. She knew exactly how pretty, with large brown eyes that made some mistakenly think her innocent, even harmless. She knew she was neither, but it suited her very well to have others believe her so, especially here, today. This carriage had taken almost the last of the gold she had managed to carry away when she fled Tyr. If she was to re-establish herself, she needed powerful friends, and there was none more powerful in Andor than the woman she had come to see. The carriage halted near a fountain in a column-ringed courtyard, and a servant in red and white livery rushed to open the door. Altima barely glanced at the courtyard or the serving man. Her mind was all on the meeting ahead. Black hair spilled to the middle of her back from beneath a close-fitting cap of seed pearls, and more pearls lined the tiny pleats of her high-necked gown of watery green silk. She had met Morgaze once, briefly, 5 years ago during a state visit, a woman who radiated power, as reserved and stately as one should expect of a queen, and also proper in the Andoran way, which meant prim. The rumors in the city that she had a lover, a man not much liked, it seemed, did not fit that very well, of course. But from what Altima remembered, the formality of the gown and the high neck should please Morgaze. As soon as Altima's slippers were firmly on the paving stones, the maid, Kara, leaped down and began fussing over the fall of the pleats, until Altima snapped her fan shut and slapped the girl's wrist with it. A courtyard was no place for that. Kara, such a foolish name, flinched back, clutching her wrist with a wounded look and the beginnings of tears. Altima compressed her lips in irritation. The girl did not even know how to take mild reproof. She had been fooling herself. The girl would not do. She was too obviously untrained. But a lady had to have a maid, especially if she was to differentiate herself from the mass of refugees in Andor. She had seen men and women laboring in the sun, even begging in the streets, while wearing the remnants of Kyrian and noble's garb. She thought she had recognized one or two. Perhaps she should take one of them in service. Who could know the duties of a lady's maid better than a lady? And if they were reduced to working with their hands, they should leap at the chance. It might be amusing to have a former friend for a maid. Too late for today, though. And an untrained maid, a local girl, said a little too clearly that Altima was at the edge of her resources, only one step removed from those beggars herself. She put on a look of concerned gentleness. "Did I hurt you, Kara?" she said sweetly. "Remain here in the carriage and soothe your wrist. I'm certain someone will bring you cool water to drink." The mindless gratitude on the girl's face was stupefying. The liveried men, well-trained, stood looking at nothing at all. Still, word of Altima's kindness would spread if she knew anything about servants. A tall young man appeared before her in the white-collared red coat and burnished breastplate of the Queen's Guard, bowing with a hand to his sword-hilt. "I am Guardsman Lieutenant Talanvor, High Lady. If you will come with me, I will escort you to Queen Morgaze." He offered an arm, which she took, but otherwise she was scarcely aware of him. She had no interest in soldiers, unless generals and lords. As he attended her down broad corridors, seemingly full of scurrying men and women in livery, they took care not to impede her way, of course. She subtly examined the fine wall hangings, the ivory-inlaid chests and high chests, the bowls and vases of chased gold or silver, or thin sea-folk porcelain. The royal palace did not display as much wealth as the Stone of Tyr, but Andor was still a wealthy land, perhaps even as wealthy as Tyr. An older lord would do nicely, malleable for a woman still young, perhaps a touch feeble and infirm. With vast estates, that would be a beginning, while she found out exactly where the strings of power lay in Andor. A few words exchanged with Morgaze some years ago were not much of an introduction, but she had that which a powerful queen must want and need. Information. Finally, Talanvor ushered her into a large sitting room with a high ceiling painted in birds and clouds and open sky, where ornately carved and gilded chairs stood before a polished white marble fireplace. A part of Altima's mind noted with amusement that the wide red and gold carpet was Tyran work. The young man went to one knee. "My queen," he said in a suddenly rough voice, "as you have commanded, I bring you the High Lady Altima of Tyr." Morgaze waved him away. "You are welcome, Altima. It is good to see you again. Sit, and we will talk." Altima managed a curtsy and murmured thanks before taking a chair. Envy curdled inside her. She had remembered Morgaze as a beautiful woman, but the golden-haired reality told her how pale that memory had grown. Morgaze was a rose in full bloom, ready to overshadow every other flower. Altima did not blame the young soldier for stumbling on his way out. She was just glad he was gone, so she would not have to be aware of him looking at the two of them, comparing. Yet there were changes, too. Vast changes. Morgaze, by the grace of the light, Queen of Andor, defender of the realm, protector of the people, high seat of House Trakand, so very reserved and stately and proper, wore a gown of shimmering white silk that showed enough bosom to shock a tavern maid in the mall. It clung to hip and thigh close enough to suit a Tarabonner jade. The rumors were clearly true. Morgaze had a lover, and for her to have altered so much, it was equally clear that she tried to please this Gabriel, not make him please her. Morgaze still radiated power and a presence that filled the room, but that dress transformed both to something less. Altima was doubly glad she had worn a high neck. A woman that deep in a man's thrall could lash out in a jealous rage on the smallest provocation, or none at all. If she met Gabriel, she would present him as near indifference as civility would allow. Even being suspected of thinking of poaching Morgaze's lover could get her a hangman's noose instead of a rich husband on his last legs. She herself would have done the same. A woman in red and white livery brought wine, an excellent Morandian, and poured it into crystal goblets deeply engraved with the rearing lion of Andor. As Morgaze took a goblet, Altima noticed her ring, a golden serpent eating its own tail. The great serpent ring was worn by some women who had trained in the White Tower, as Morgaze had, without becoming Aes Sedai, as well as by Aes Sedai themselves. It was a thousand-year tradition for the queens of Andor to be tower-trained, but rumors were on every lip of a break between Morgaze and Tar Valon, and the anti-Aes Sedai sentiment in the streets could have been quashed quickly had Morgaze wanted to. Why was she still wearing the ring? Altima would be careful of her words until she knew the answer. The liveried woman withdrew to the far end of the room, out of earshot but close enough to see when the wine needed replenishing. Taking a sip, Morgaze said, "It is long since we met. Is your husband well? Is he in Camelon with you?" Hastily, Altima shuffled her plans. She had not thought Morgaze knew she had a husband, but she had always been able to think on the run. "Tedosian was well when I last saw him. The light sent he died soon, as well to get on with it. He was of some question about serving this Randall Thor, and that is a dangerous chasm to straddle. Why, lords have been hung as if they were common criminals." "Randall Thor," Morgaze mused softly. "I met him once. He did not look like one who would name himself the Dragon Reborn, a frightened shepherd boy, trying not to show it. Yet, thinking back, he seemed to be looking for some escape." Her blue eyes looked inward. "Elida warned me of him." She seemed unaware of having spoken those last words. "Elida was your advisor, then?" Altima said cautiously. She knew it was so, and it made the rumors of a break all the more difficult to believe. She had to know if it was true. "You have replaced her, now that she is Amarlin?" Morgaze's eyes snapped back into focus. "I have not." The next instant, her voice softened again. "My daughter Elaine is training in the tower. She has already been raised to the accepted." Altima fluttered her fan, hoping sweat was not breaking out on her forehead. If Morgaze did not know her own feelings toward the tower, there was no way to speak safely. Her plans teetered on the edge of a precipice. Then Morgaze rescued them and her. "You say your husband was of two minds about Randall Thor. And you?" She nearly sighed with relief. Morgaze might be behaving like an untutored farm girl over this Gabriel, but she still had her sense when it came to power and possible dangers to her realm. "I observed him closely, of course, in the stone. That should plant the seed, if it needed planting. He can channel, and a man who can channel is always to be feared. Yet he is the Dragon Reborn, there is no doubt. The stone fell, and Kalendor was in his hand when it did. The prophecies... I fear I must leave decisions of what to do about the Dragon Reborn to those who are wiser than I. I only know that I am afraid to remain where he rules. Even a High Lady of Tyr cannot match the courage of the Queen of Andor." The golden-haired woman gave her a shrewd look that made her afraid she had overdone the flattery. Some did not like it too open. But Morgaze merely leaned back in her chair and sipped her wine. "Tell me about him, this man who is supposed to save us, and destroy us doing it. Success, or at least the beginnings of it. He is a dangerous man beyond any question of the power. A lion seems lazy, half asleep, until suddenly he charges. Then he is all speed and power. Randall Thor seems innocent, not lazy, and naive, not asleep. But when he charges, he has no proper respect for person or position at all. I did not exaggerate when I said he has hanged lords. He is a breeder of anarchy. In Tyr, under his new laws, even a high lord or lady can be called before a magistrate to be fined, or worse, on the charges of the meanest peasant or fisherman. She kept strictly to the truth as she saw it. She could tell the truth as quickly as a lie when it was necessary. Morgaze sipped her wine and listened. Altima might have thought her lounging indolently, except that her eyes showed she was taking in every word and storing it. "You must understand," Altima finished, "that I have only touched the surface. Randall Thor and what he has done in Tyr are subjects for hours." "You will have them," Morgaze said, and in her mind Altima smiled. "Success!" "Is it true," the queen went on, "that he brought Aiel with him to the stone?" "Oh, yes. Great savages with their faces hidden half the time, and even the women ready to kill as soon as look. They followed him like dogs, terrorizing everyone, and took whatever they wanted from the stone." "I had thought it must be the wildest rumor," Morgaze reflected. "There have been rumors this past year, but they have not come out of the waste in 20 years, not since the Aiel War. The world certainly does not need this Randall Thor bringing the Aiel down on us again." Her look sharpened again. "You said, followed. They have gone?" Altima nodded. "Just before I left Tyr, and he went with them." "With them?" Morgaze exclaimed. "I feared he was in Cairhien right this—" "You have a guest, Morgaze? I should have been told, so I could greet her." A big man strode into the room, tall, his gold-embroidered red silk coat fitting massive shoulders and a deep chest. Altima did not need to see the radiant look on Morgaze's face to name him as Lord Gabriel. The assurance with which he had interrupted the queen did that. He lifted a finger, and the serving woman curtsied and left quickly. He did not ask Morgaze's permission to dismiss her servants from her presence either. He was darkly handsome, incredibly so, with wings of white at his temples. Composing her face to commonplace, Altima put on a marginally welcoming smile, suitable for an elderly uncle with neither power, wealth, nor influence. He might be gorgeous, but even if he did not belong to Morgaze, he was not a man she would try manipulating unless she absolutely had to. There was perhaps even more of an air of power about him than about Morgaze. Gabriel stopped by Morgaze and put his hand on her bare shoulder in a very familiar way. She clearly came close to resting her cheek on the back of his hand, but his eyes were on Altima. She was used to men looking at her, but these eyes made her shift uneasily. They were far too penetrating, saw far too much. "You come from Tyr?" The sound of his deep voice sent a tingle through her. Her skin, even her bones, felt as though she had been dipped in icy water. But oddly, her momentary anxiety melted. It was Morgaze who answered. Altima could not seem to find her tongue with him watching her. "This is the High Lady Altima, Gabriel. She has been telling me all about the Dragon Reborn. She was in the Stone of Tyr when it fell. Gabriel, there really were Aiel—" The pressure of his hand cut her off. Irritation flashed across her face, but then it was gone, replaced by a smile beaming up at him. His eyes, still on Altima, sent that shiver through her again, and this time she gasped aloud. "So much talking must have fatigued you, Morgaze," he said without shifting his gaze. "You do too much. Go to your bedchamber and sleep. Go now. I will wake you when you have rested enough." Morgaze stood immediately, still smiling at him devotedly. Her eyes seemed slightly glazed. "Yes, I am tired. I will take a nap now, Gabriel." She glided from the room with never a glance at Altima, but Altima's attention was all on Gabriel. Her heart beat faster. Her breath quickened. He was surely the handsomest man she had ever seen. The grandest, the strongest, the most powerful. Superlatives rolled through her mind like a flood. Gabriel paid no more attention to Morgaze's leaving than she did. Taking the chair the queen had vacated, he leaned back with his boots stretched out in front of him. "Tell me why you came to Camelon, Altima." Again the chill ran through her. "The absolute truth, but keep it brief. You can give me details later if I want them." She did not hesitate. "I tried to poison my husband and had to flee before Tadosian and that trull Estanda could kill me instead, or worse. Randall Thor meant to let them do it as an example." Telling made her cringe. Not because it was a truth she had kept hidden, so much as because she found she wanted to please him more than anything else in the world, and she feared that he might send her away. But he wanted the truth. "I chose Camelon because I could not bear Ilion, and though Andor is little better, Cairhien is in near ruins. In Camelon I can find a wealthy husband, or one who thinks he is my protector if need be, and use his power to—" He stopped her with a wave of his hand, chuckling. "A vicious little cat, though pretty. Perhaps pretty enough to keep, with your teeth and claws drawn." Suddenly his face became more intent. "Tell me what you know of Randall Thor, and especially his friends, if he has any, his companions, his allies." She told him, talking until her mouth and throat went dry, and her voice cracked and rasped. She never raised her goblet until he told her to drink. Then she gulped the wine down and spoke on. She could please him. She could please him better than Morgaze could think of. The maids working in Morgaze's bedchamber dropped hasty curtsies, surprised to see her there in the middle of the morning. Waving them out of the room, she climbed onto her bed, still in her dress. For a time she lay staring at the gilded carvings of the bedposts. No lions of Andor here, but roses, for the rose crown of Andor, but roses suited her better than lions. "Stop being stubborn," she chided herself, then wondered why. She had told Gabriel she was tired, and—or had he told her? Impossible! She was the queen of Andor, and no man told her to do anything. Gareth! Now why had she thought of Gareth Bryn? He had certainly never told her to do anything. The captain general of the queen's guards obeyed the queen, not the other way around. But he had been stubborn, entirely capable of digging in his heels until she came around to his way. Why am I thinking of him? I wish he were here. That was ridiculous. She had sent him away for opposing her. About what no longer seemed quite clear, but that was not important. He had opposed her. She could remember the feelings she had had for him only dimly, as though he had been gone for years. Surely it had not been so long. Stop being stubborn. Her eyes closed, and she fell immediately into sleep. A sleep troubled by restless dreams of running from something she could not see.
Chapter 2. Rudian. High in the city of Rudian, Randall Thor looked out from a tall window. Whatever glass might have once been in it was long since gone. The shadows below slanted sharply east. A bard harp played softly in the room behind him. Sweat evaporated from his face almost as soon as it appeared. His red silk coat, damp between the shoulders, hung open in a fruitless bid for air, and his shirt was unlaced half down his chest. Night in the Aiel Waste would bring freezing cold, but during daylight even a breeze was never cool. With his hands above his head and the smooth stone window frame, his coat sleeves fell down to reveal the front part of the figure wrapped around each forearm. A golden-maned serpentine creature, with eyes like the sun, scaled in scarlet and gold, each foot tipped with 5 golden claws. Part of his skin they were, not tattoos. They glittered like precious metals and polished gems, seemed almost alive in the late afternoon sun. Those marked him to the people on this side of the mountain range, variously called the Dragon Wall or the Spine of the World, as He Who Comes with the Dawn. And like the herons branded into his palms, they marked him for those beyond the Dragon Wall too, according to the prophecies, as the Dragon Reborn. In both cases, prophesied to unite, save, and destroy. They were names he would have avoided if he could, but that time was long past, if it had ever existed, and he no longer thought of it, or if he did, on rare occasion, it was with the faint regret of a man recalling a foolish dream of his boyhood, as if he were not close enough to boyhood to remember every minute. Instead, he tried to think only of what he had to do. Fate and duty held him on the path like a rider's reins, but he had often been called stubborn. The end of the road must be reached, but if it could be attained by a different way, maybe it need not be the end. Small chance. No chance, almost certainly. The prophecies demanded his blood. Rudion stretched below him, seared by a sun still pitiless as it sank toward craggy mountains, bleak, with barely a sign of vegetation. This rugged, broken land, where men had killed or died over a pool of water they could step across, was the last place on earth anyone would think to find a great city. Its long-ago builders had never finished their work. Impossibly tall buildings dotted the city, stepped and slab-sided palaces that sometimes ended after 8 or even 10 stories, not with a roof, but with the ragged masonry of another half-built floor. The towers soared higher yet, but stopped in jagged abruptness as often as not. Now a good quarter of the great structures, with their massive columns and immense windows of colored glass, lay strewn as rubble across wide avenues with broad strips of bare dirt down their centers. Dirt that had never held the trees they were planned for. The marvelous fountains stood dry as they had for hundreds upon hundreds of years. All that futile labor, the builders finally dying with their work undone. Yet at times Rand thought that maybe the city had only been begun so he could find it. Too proud, he thought. A man would have to be half mad at least to be so proud. He could not help chuckling dryly. There had been Aes Sedai with the men and women who had come here so long ago, and they had known the Kariathon cycle, the prophecies of the dragon. Or perhaps they had written the prophecies. Too proud by tenfold. Directly below him lay a vast plaza, half covered in stretching shadow, littered with a jumble of statues and crystal chairs, oddities and peculiar shapes of metal or glass or stone, things he could put no name to, scattered about in tangled heaps as if deposited by a storm. Even the shadows were cool, only by comparison. Rough-clothed men, not Aiel, sweated to load wagons with items chosen by a short, slender woman in pristine blue silk, straight-backed and gliding from place to place, as though the heat did not press down on her as hard as on the others. Still, she wore a damp white cloth tied around her temples. She just did not let herself show the effects of the sun. Rand would have wagered she did not even perspire. The workman's leader was a dark, bulky man named Hadnan Kadir. A supposed merchant dressed all in cream-colored silk that was sweat-sodden today. He mopped his face continually with a large handkerchief, shouting curses at the men, his wagon drivers and guards. But he leaped as quickly as they to haul at whatever the slim woman pointed out, big or small. Aes Sedai had no need of size to impose their will, but Rand thought that Moraine would have done as well if she had never been near the White Tower. Two of the men were trying to move what appeared to be an oddly twisted redstone door frame. The corners did not meet properly, and the eye did not want to follow the straight pieces. It stayed upright, turning freely but refusing to tip over, however they manhandled it. Then one slipped and fell, through the doorway, up to his waist. Rand tensed. For a moment the fellow seemed not to exist above the waist, his legs kicking wildly in panic. Until Lan, A tall man in drab shades of green strode over and hauled him out again by his belt. Lan was Moraine's warder. Bonded to her in some way, Rand did not understand, and a hard man who moved like the Aiel, like a hunting wolf. The sword at his hip did not seem part of him, it was part of him. He dropped the workman on the paving stones and the seat of his breeches and left him there. The fellow's terrified cries rose thinly to Rand, and his companion looked ready to run. Several of Kadir's men, who had been close enough to see, were looking at one another and at the mountains around the city, plainly assessing their chances. Moraine appeared among them so quickly it seemed by the power, moving smoothly from man to man. Her manner made Rand almost hear the cool, imperious instructions coming from her lips, so full of certainty that they would be obeyed that not obeying would seem foolish. In short order, she overrode resistance, stamped firmly on objections, chivied them every one back to work. The pair with the door frame were soon dragging and shoving as hard as ever, if with frequent looks at Moraine, when they thought she would not see.